over there. We just can't see it.
Thank you.
It's sort of how it is. Yeah.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
So, do we have a motion to approve the agenda as presented?
So moved.
Second. One thing I recommend that the boater guy do when we get the camera,
yes,
the TV in here.
Yes, we've already had that conversation with Sam. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
So, public comments. We have a important meeting ahead of us today. Thank you. And it's quite possible that after you hear the meeting, there will be public comment that wants to be made at that time. And so I think what we will make sure is that there is the opportunity for public comment not only at the beginning of the meeting, but also at the end. We do have Nancy Tichy signed up for public comment. Excellent. That's fine. When we get there, it'll be whoever. Okay, so the first thing is the consent agenda, the first specific item. These matters are routine and will be enacted as a single vote, basically without separate discussion. And if either of the other commissioners would like one of the items moved to a separate item, this would be the time to say so. Bruce,
Paul? No, I saw them.
I move the approval of the consent agenda.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
So we have now presentations. The first is the Pacific Northwest Voter Guide, Port of Kingston, and presentation of a new port promotional video on the magic machine that has just been brought to us. Okay. Would you like us to...
Man, could you open the door there, please, for people? Embrace it so people can get in.
Sam, would you like us to wait?
I guess we will wait on the presentation.
Okay, cool. So let us move to the curb feasibility study, downtown waterfront properties and site development plan presented by Heartland LLC. If you could begin by introducing yourself, that would be terrific.
I'm Matt Hoffman, Senior Project Manager of Heartland.
I'm Matt Anderson, Principal of Heartland.
I'm Carson Bowen, Associate Project Manager.
Well, thank you. And I think the floor at this point is yours.
Well, first let me thank you guys for having us back. And this has been a really enjoyable process for us, working with you and the community here in Kingston. And looking at these properties, and how they fit into the community as a whole. Our presentation today is really kind of based on the final product that we have, and there's going to be our copies available. Our thought was we would kind of walk through the key findings from each of the sections through the document. We're happy to make this as conversational as everybody would like, and we can answer questions kind of as we go, and we'll go from there.
Great. All right. So, like Matt said, we're just going to be walking through the presentation and highlighting some key points from it. Yes.
Does everyone in the audience have a copy of this? There should be some over there. Do we have more?
There's an extra one in yours.
Do you need yours? We have this.
Yeah, I have this. I don't know that that is the most absolute current version, but I certainly don't need it. I share that with you.
Does anyone else? This isn't the most current one, but it is a draft and does have the pictures.
Are these the ones that were asked?
Yes.
But they're not, so this is not the most current draft.
That is the most current.
That is.
Yeah.
There's actually
say that would be
if it says draft on it, there is a it's been changed.
Are the basic pictures the same?
Yes.
The voiceover is not.
As Matt said, we really enjoyed working on this project. These properties are very compelling. We think there's some real opportunity that can be had from them. To understand that, to evaluate that, we took an iterative approach to evaluating these two sites. We call them the West Kingston site, which is the one, the kind of north parking lot here, or rather west parking lot, and the Washington site, which is right by the ferry terminal, and the Mike Wallace Park. So the process, in short, was we did a baseline analysis, and this is in the report, but I just want to voice over all of this so it's on the record. We did a baseline analysis that involved existing conditions, understanding what can and can't be done on the property, so we can push and pull on those existing conditions. We then did our first of two community engagement activities, two two-hour visioning sessions, and that helped inform that, along with market assessment that we ran, informed some development concepts that we tested, or we looked at and presented in a second visit to the community, where we walked through four alternatives for the sites. From that, we came down to four final concepts that we tested. Those are presented here in this report, and we also provided an engagement strategy to act on back to those properties. Next, Carson will talk a little bit about the properties, just to give everyone in the room our take on each.
Yeah, so it's important to understand the regional context for these sites in terms of what's happening in the greater Puget Sound area and how that affects these particular parcels. On page 4 of the presentation, we talk about regional connectivity and talk about commute times, because that lends itself to the demand that these sites will have for certain uses, be it residential, vacation, whatever, that was considered as part of the community outreach process. The big game changer is the passenger ferry, which we mentioned. It'll take, you can see within the context of other modes of transport, be it driving or traditional ferries, it shrinks that time significantly in terms of access to downtown Seattle. So to project it at this point, 33-minute commute. So that's on page 4. On page 5, we lay out on a map some of the regulatory constraints that are on the site, be it the Shoreline Management Act, which affects the setbacks from the water, and then also the existing zoning that's in place for the two sites. We also show the connectivity of the sites to the downtown. Obviously, they're both very walkable. They're close to public parks. They're close to the ferry. They're close to the marina. So there's a lot of upside from that standpoint. And then we highlight on page 5 a number of the downtown improvements that are projected that will substantially add value to the downtown experience and complement these sites as well. So that shows some of the regional considerations, physical attributes, zoning, the size. The West Kingston parcel is about 2.75 acres, so good size parcel. And then the Washington Boulevard is just under one parcel, like 6.8 acres. And obviously very close to downtown. On page 6, we show some of the existing zoning, so it shows the height of a future project, so you can't build above 35 feet, so roughly 3 stories. That shows lot coverage, and it also shows the number of units that you can have on the parcel as well, which is another constraint. So that's a quick overview of some of the regulatory and regional context for the sites.
Thanks, Carson. And when we started this project, the election hadn't happened yet, the vote on the fast ferry. So that was certainly a game changer, and having that certainty kind of helped help us think through some of these properties a little differently. So that was a key factor. The shoreline, as Carson mentioned, is also a factor, and that affects only the West Kingston site, at those setbacks. It touches on the Washington site, but it is not an impact of use.
Excuse me, if I may please interject a question based on what Carson was just talking about. I know the Shoreline Management Act and the setbacks required there are pretty intractable. In working with these and the various options, did you look at the potential for zoning changes?
The zoning changes, it's obviously driven by use. And if the current zoning doesn't allow for it, so the hotels, for example, I believe are conditional use.
Can you all hear all of this?
He could talk a little bit louder. Not you, but I'm going to want to point it this way. I mean, I'm sorry, not you.
We will just.
Well, it projects that way. It kind of comes back mumble a little bit. Don't you admit a little bit mumble?
Point this way.
Yeah.
Just, thank you.
Something maybe a minor point. There's actually another restriction. It's a critical areas ordinance. And that establishes the buffer zone, which is intractable. But the shoreline setback governs the use in that setback area. So you can have activities in that 250-foot zone. It's just that it's regulated by the SMP.
Right.
And then the other thing in density, a developer could create trade density for this property, too. So you could actually achieve higher densities than what you've listed here if you had that sort of arrangement.
Yes, and there's also opportunity potentially for taking something to the county, proposal to the county to modify the zoning in downtown Kingston as well. For example, the West Kingston site is adjacent to the urban zone. It's not in that higher density zone, so that could be a recommendation if the use calls for it. So that's about the condition of the property. Wanted to spend a little bit of time on the outreach that we engaged with the community on, which we thought was a very effective use of everyone's time. It helped inform us on the types of uses that were desired, the gaps, existing attitudes towards Kingston, and the future, attitudes towards the future of it. So we reviewed the Brooks study, which was a very in-depth survey that went out to, I think there's 173 respondents. We distilled the raw data to kind of create some word clouds based on a few of those questions to help identify what themes stood out. The three questions we looked at there were Kingston's greatest assets, what you'd like to see in downtown Kingston, and what you think Kingston is best known for, so kind of Kingston's image. And we thought we chose those three because we felt that they would help us most inform these three projects, inform what could be done with these three projects. And then we asked seven other questions. I won't read them off to you, they're in the report, but each one of these questions generated a lot of discussion in the two-hour visioning sessions that we had. We captured all of that discussion in a series of notes. Each table captain kind of captured everything. We generated these word clouds. Some of the key output from that was a strong understanding of the importance of the waterfront to the community, the walkability of the community, good and bad. It was cited as both a good opportunity, but at the same time, traffic, another common theme, impedes walkability and the use of downtown at certain times. In terms of uses, restaurants, some of the restaurants, existing restaurants were noted as favorites, specifically, people really liked some of the existing restaurants that were great, but others cited variety, and having more restaurants, different kinds of restaurants would be a great aspect to them. Lodging was cited as a potential use, or desire. And family-friendly and improved water access were also noted, or at least captured in a large part of the discussions that we had at the tables. So these discussions, we'll take questions on the output of this if anyone has them, but I'm going to move over to the next section where we kind of took a look at some of the drivers, market drivers for Kingston, and have that help. That helped inform some of the user uses that we considered in the concepts.
So from the community outreach, we were given a spectrum of different uses to consider. And using the demographics, we were able to then backfill data to see if they're actually viable or not. And obviously, there's a lot of growth that's taking place in the Seattle area, and we wanted to see if that was translated to Kingston as well. And the conclusion from the data that comes from what's called the Puget Sound Research Council, Regional Council, showed that the growth and population forecasts are not matching what Seattle's are in terms of a percentage increase. And there's one variable, which is the fast ferry, to see if some of that growth from the Seattle area bleeds because of the new connectivity into Kingston. But as is, if that variable was off the table, then the growth wouldn't be substantial. And that's shown in the charts that are on page 15. And that's projected out to 2040, so there's obviously a lot of variability built into that. But that informs uses such as multifamily in terms of people who are younger families, their interest in moving to the community, job growth, things like that trickle from that demographic forecast. So that was really important to understand and then help inform a number of the uses that we considered. You can also look at ferry passage, the passengers' age distribution. Those are also important, and we've collected our observations at the bottom of the page there. On page 16, we look at some of the economic drivers, which are just as impactful for future uses. What we did was we looked at this on a comparative basis around the Puget Sound, so looked at other communities that are comparable or nearby, such as Bainbridge, the greater Kitsap County, Bremerton, and then Seattle as well.
What?
Yes.
Where did you get that growth? What's the source of that?
The one that I put on population?
Yeah.
That's from the Puget Sound Regional Council.
When?
2015.
Have you talked to any realtors in this area in the last year?
Oh, no, it's, yeah, the numbers.
They're going to tell you a total different story.
Yeah.
So this is a population forecast out to 2005.
I got it. I'm just saying that needs to be adjusted based on after the ferry was voted on and what our realtors are experiencing right now.
Absolutely. And that's the one key variable that's going to change that number.
Is it within your scope to make that change? Because it changes the whole thing.
You know, we agree that the fast ferry is going to change the growth projection. We're just telling you what the projection had been.
So is it within your scope to change it, or are you guys...
No, we would have had to. In order to do that, it's a great question. In order to do that, you would want to do a buildable lands study of kind of the area most influenced by the ferry, and you would want to project forward based on kind of growth and absorption with the fast ferry in place. Our purview was two properties that the port owns, so this is solely to inform the study of the use of those, which you're absolutely right. There should be a broader study of how residential growth in particular is going to happen now that there's
just a question. The PSRC study, does that identify Kingston as a population center they analyze for?
It's a forecast area zone, the FAS.
So
it's a bigger area than the downtown.
Yeah, so I was kind of wondering what they mean by Kingston when they say, because there's a lot of different definitions.
Yeah.
So what do they mean in the population growth study that you saw of Kingston? Is it, because this is a very small sector, so.
So the question again
is what is a geographical area that the Puget Sound growth projections were aiming at?
It goes up to Fort Campbell. It goes down to the geography. It's
down to Indianola, down to the south,
and almost all the way over to 3. So it's a much bigger area than what it is.
So there could be variance within that geographic region that might account for the point Dave made, that we've seen real estate boom in maybe the urban areas, whereas not the rural areas.
But even so, I mean, just picking on these projections, they had, I think it was 1,500 units that they were projecting during the 2025 mm-hmm. to 2040 period. So the fast ferry is going to be established by then, growth will have happened. The question, like Matt said, is how much land is going to be left to build to fill out the, to support population growth? At what density will that be? You've got Arborwood, which is 750 units, so you know that's gonna add a lot of new households. But you know, our educated professional opinion, I guess rather, would be that the growth projections the PSFC has right now, the 2015 ones, they're going to get revised. The fast ferry is going to greatly influence their next round of projections, and the anticipated growth will be higher than what it is.
Would you say then that the area of this project,
yes,
within, say, 2 miles, will see significantly larger growth than what's been projected because of the density of an urban area and the,
yes,
county policy?
Yes. The growth PSRC projections,
okay,
are very, they're kind of big economic,
yep, yep,
projections for the region, and they always lag actual growth if the market is improving, and similarly if things are changing, it just doesn't happen real time enough.
There's
and
also,
even then, they're,
yeah,
very, they're gross.
There's also an incentive to densify the urban areas.
Absolutely.
Which this is.
Mm-hmm.
So that
the other element of the PSRC projections is that they're very focused on transportation impacts. And I would anticipate that the next update will show an uptick, because that's what they're designed to do, is to deal,
yeah,
with transportation.
And I would just to emphasize that there's PSRC's top-down economic projection that goes out a long ways, but they update on a similar methodology on a regular basis. What it misses, which is a huge issue, is that it misses on the ground. You know, there's a big project that's approved here that's 700 units. The PSRC,
mm-hmm,
unless they're really blending in a full buildable lands study, they're going to miss that. So they're showing you kind of general economic growth, household formation, and they distribute that. But when you get down to a small area that has a big impact, like a 30-minute ferry to downtown, and a project that's already approved and more that could come, it's just never going to be accurate. So talking to, you know, knowing what realtors are saying is much more accurate, because it's today, it's right now. And even more importantly, it's what people are saying, and they're the ones who are going to feel it kind of at the front of it. But it's not going to magically come into a projection, that matches the same methodology that a PSRC or a regional council would use.
The other element of the PSRC numbers that I think is worth mentioning is that they are built off Kitsap County's comprehensive plan and numbers. So there's whatever lag exists in the county numbers then gets passed on to the regional numbers, and then when we try to use them, they're a little out of date. Maybe not a lot out of date.
I was surprised at the median income. It was higher than I seem to remember. Is that, and it's almost Seattle's. So that Kingston's median income is the same as Seattle's, kind of hard for me to get my mind around. But is that kind of reflecting a bedroom community? Is that what these numbers are telling us?
It's a really small, it's a small sample, right, compared to the whole of Seattle,
mm-hmm,
to Kingston. So, you know, it wasn't terribly surprising to us.
Okay.
And so, if you move to page 16, I'd say one of the biggest takeaways from this page is the median home price. And if we think about being within 33 minutes of downtown Seattle with a median home price of a little over $300,000, that can be a game changer. Because from downtown Seattle, if you're going to commute 30 minutes, that gets you to Bellevue these days. The center of life, barely. So, when you think about having a stress-free commute in a beautiful setting on a boat, that's going to be attractive to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And that's an opportunity. And so we've thought about the future uses through that lens. That's a huge takeaway. Sales taxes, cost of doing business, property taxes, they're only getting higher in Seattle, I can tell you that, and they're much more favorable here. So that's another tailwind. So we'll move to page 17, which actually is tailwinds and headwinds. Matt just talked about Arborwood. Having more amenities that will come from having a development of that scale, restaurants, businesses, better transportation, better roads, sidewalks, better parks, those are all good things. And those will all support value and future uses for these sites downtown. The fast ferry, we've talked about that at length. We'll continue to talk about it. You should all talk about it to your friends as well. And so there's two other pretty impactful tailwinds, which is the complete streets, which is planned for 2018, major improvements to the downtown grid. This is going to increase walkability, the pedestrian experience. It's going to help your local retail. It's going to cause people who maybe otherwise would have just driven through on their ferry to take a minute and pause downtown and spend some money, which is great.
Question on that. I think there's something underneath Complete Streets that's worthy of motion. Notices the rerouting 104. Insofar as that's so close to our properties, and we mentioned that downtown congestion is a factor in downtown development, that the completion of that project would be helpful for us to, if this report acknowledged that that can actually have a very positive economic benefit for the town, because particularly our project, which is like one block away, and to remove that congestion from that proximity both helps people on West Kingston Road, but also maybe users of a hotel or motel or restaurant that you had in this project on Washington Boulevard.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah, couldn't agree more.
Quick question. Is it okay?
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. You're talking about this Complete Streets and the potential for change in rerouting 104 as something that is funded. I'm not aware that there's any. What? You're discussing it in a way that it's happening.
Okay, sure.
We have continuously been told that there's no funding for it, there is not a whole plan for it, so while that's a great idea, cool. I'm not sure that we should be considering it's real.
Okay.
So unless we have new.
No, we don't have information. I would offer that it was funded through 70% design. Then we went back and did a modeling of the intersection, you know, and then we went and did Complete Streets, which has to do with the rest of downtown. And there's pre-design engineering money in the budget now. And so that's kind of the baby steps. Would it get funded at the end? I don't know. It's a good point.
Agree, but you're prescribing it like you should be consuming it.
No.
So phase one and two is funded, starting at 19. They pushed funding to 19.
Okay.
But Washington Boulevard, the entire length of Washington Boulevard, which is two phases, will be funded early 19.
So does that mean they're still going to be coming straight up and going that one way?
Yeah, they haven't changed the ferry, but Washington Boulevard will be changed.
That's a huge problem, because when people get off the ferry, too, they miss the middle of town.
So we're a couple biennium's away from even having clarity on that issue, I think.
On the 104.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Dave, could I ask you what, if you have anything else to add to that from your knowledge?
Well, only that there's a meeting, $500,000 was approved in the budget by Christine Rolfes towards what we can do. Working group has been reconvened, and we're looking at a couple of options. One, if we don't have to change the pavement, then that saves a huge cost. But the drainage infrastructure would have to be done. It could be restriped. It could have three lanes, two in, one out, and if they could stage, this has to be simulated. If you're thinking they can stage three lanes coming off the ferry and merge where the new toll booths would be. Prairie still doesn't have any money for the new toll booths. So the best to be said at this point is the study has resumed.
I guess that's positive.
It is positive. I mean, the good news is we get some money.
Yeah.
So we can do something with it, and everybody in the meeting felt that it was, that we could actually, we don't have to spend all that money on engineering. There are some easy fixes that we just direct that money towards the fixes. We might actually make some progress.
And that's actually what was done in the Gorse area. They basically said, forget, we're not going to get to the real solution for decades, so let's restripe, et cetera, and improve traffic flow.
And the good news is this doesn't mean it's in a corner, because it allows you to progress to an ultimate solution later.
Yeah.
Right.
And so let's.
Okay, so, but that will change the nature of downtown, and let's just acknowledge that it'll be a different downtown if that happens.
Mm-hmm. One chart that speaks to that I want to point out is on page 15 is the ferry passenger distribution between Seattle, Bainbridge, South Arlington, and Kingston, and North Edmonds, and it shows how auto-oriented the ferry passengers are coming from Edmonds. So 52% of all riders are in a vehicle. Versus a much lower percentage at those other ferries. And so with the fast ferry, having that change would be very beneficial to the downtown. So you're not just running people right past the core where all the retail and downtown experiences as well. So that's
just something on that page, the age distribution, besides bodies, the passenger ferry can bring a different demographic.
Yeah.
So if you're trying to lead the target to where Kingston will be with a fast ferry, it's also a different demographic mix, particularly in the downtown area.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, I think the value, and this is one of the things that it bears only somewhat on the actual properties that we were studying, but I think in general is a big takeaway, at least for us. The fast ferry makes those who are living or working in downtown Seattle, it makes this a viable location to raise a family. And right now, for most people that are working there, just given how stretched everybody is for time and the rest of it, it's virtually, it would be really, really hard for most people to do that. So I think it does change it, and it does make it a destination potentially for much younger families. And given the environment in which you live, I don't have to tell you that it's an attractive scenario compared to most other choices. So I think that's a huge influence on the area. I think when you boil it down to the individual parcels that we're looking at, it's a muted effect, right? Because you've got limitations on these properties, and you know there's only so much you can do. But generally throughout the county, I think it's going to be a big change.
So another tailwind that is recent is that sites within Kingston are being thought of differently than they have in the past. And one example is the Kingston Lumber site. So there's opportunities that are exciting and different than other uses that we see around town right now. And we'll show that local groups and outside groups are interested in developing in a different way than they have in the past. And so that's an exciting tailwind. Key local challenges, most of what we talked about is the traffic circulation that we've been talking about. And that continues to be a challenge. That there, as we've talked about, there is a process in place to help mitigate that, but it will take time. Parking is another area of concern that we've identified and seen and observed. As I would imagine, especially on events like 4th of July and large high-capacity tourist days, just getting people there, but the fast ferry will also present an issue in terms of people who live in a non-walkable distance from the ferry. They will have to be either bus or shuttle or have a parking venue that they can walk to. So we highlight
just a question.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah,
of course. I did a preliminary review of the report online before coming to today's meeting, but I didn't see any particular discussion of parking for any of the proposals that you proposed or any associated parking with development of those two sites. Was that not part of your purview for this report, or did I just miss it?
Go ahead.
We highlighted it as a key consideration. The parking requirements for, say, the hotel, the restaurants, those will all, not only will some of the parking spaces be displaced for most of the uses, which is a concern, some of the uses might also actually add demand for additional parking for those uses. So that is a key consideration and something that's going to have to be thought through when negotiating for example, a long-term ground lease with a restaurateur. You know, part of that lease is going to be how the parking will be managed.
So your responsibility was to outline it as a consideration, but not to propose any solutions to that.
We showed how the parking kind of fit in this area with the parking that is available.
If the project was built such that it had its own parking, like the restaurant you could park underneath or whatever, would the residual parking meet the parking demands as you see it? Complete Streets said, you know, parking's okay, although I don't know if they're thinking about the passenger-only ferry. So I'm trying to figure out is, would we be okay if the parking was contained within the projects that you outlined?
Yes, and I think the way you want to think about it is, given the properties that you own, you're managing parking. And so some of these uses, so take the restaurant, for example, you know, it's got a peak in the evening, and not so much during the day, and you've got marina users who may peak earlier in the day. I'm not totally sure of that, but I'm guessing that there's more of that. And you have, at the moment, you've got some who are walking on potentially to the ferry, but not a lot, as Carson says. So this is really about managing the parking and the parking demand. So if one of these uses goes forward,
and you know, you're specifically looking at that, then it would be, it's as much about the operational management as it is about just counting the stalls. The last thing you want to do is invest, because parking's expensive in almost any form, even surface lots are expensive to create. So really using that as a resource and refining it as things change is going to save you tons of money. And also, nobody wants to have a lot of big empty parking lots and call it downtown. So it's really a balance. You want to make it convenient, but you also want to make it functionally.
Well, I challenge that point. I think parking is a huge factor that the port can address, not just for port use, but for all the community use and any future development that goes there. Anything you put in is going to have a net detrimental effect on parking. It's not all about management, because you don't know what's going to go in there in particular. And parking itself has a huge return on investment if you look at it as an investment. So I think you need to get some facts. The port has missed a master plan, and it's hard to be looking at these developments without a master plan to go against. So they're just going to paint us in the corner down the road. We're going to be dealing with parking in a bigger way than we are right now.
I agree. And if you look at an aerial shot of our downtown, 60% of all of that area is parking right now. 60%. I agree with Dave, 100%.
So you would add parking?
No.
No, I'm just saying that you have to address that with some numbers.
Well, we did address how these projects would be parked. But I think what you're raising and what we heard at the community meetings was, depending on how people use downtown, they have a lot of concerns about the availability of parking. Because it's not all universally available for every use, right? So you can park on the street, but everybody else has a parking lot.
Kathy? Along those same lines, and maybe I should be addressing it to the Park Commission and instead of to you gentlemen. Right now in the summer, we all know parking is at a premium. I have experienced myself where I was meeting a relative from the other end of the ferry, and I could not find, on a Saturday, I could not find a two-hour parking space. The market was closed, so it wasn't because of the market. I went round and round and eventually found one two-hour parking space, and I was cautioned by a port employee that was only two-hour parking, and I said yes, that I understood, because I was just walking on the ferry, meeting someone at the other end and taking the same next boat back, so I could fit, and I did fit within that two-hour premium. However, it's becoming increasingly problematic with permit parking, and there is paid parking, but I've had several situations, particularly in the summer, where there is no paid parking available, there is no two-hour parking available, and basically I'm parking, you know, and walking a pretty good distance, and there's no handicap parking for my husband who requires that. So the fast ferry, if the percentage of people abandoning their vehicles and walking on is going to be an issue, has the Port Commission addressed parking in conjunction with the fast ferry, and then based on the results of your studies, additional parking for the restaurant, etc.?
This has been a topic of conversation for sure. Jim?
Yeah, again, the fast ferry is a Kitsap Transit project, and yes, it's going to impact all of Kingston. Kitsap Transit is working on different elements of how parking is being. They still believe that quite a few of their riders are going to park at George's Corner. It's going to be busking. So that is one thing. They are also negotiating with the church to use the church parking lot during the week for commuters. So there has been discussion. Kitsap Transit is working on in conjunction with the Port of Kingston.
Just my perspective, I'm trying to get this, is that we did a parking study in Complete Streets. They said on the current condition, it's okay. If the projects we have are self-contained in parking, that would mean that that's okay. The wild card is the passenger ferries, and I think that's an impact that Kitsap Transit has to address, and they haven't addressed it yet. So I don't think we have facts, like you say. We don't have numbers and facts to know what is the effect of the ferry, because not everybody wants a bus, you know. Yeah.
I think that in hearing your plans, you know, and I'm just listening, but what I'm hearing is that you aren't addressing, you're saying you want to do all these other things, whether it's cottages or whether it's boutique hotels or whether it's additional restaurants and some of all these wonderful things. But what I'm hearing is you're not addressing also the passenger-only ferry coming in and the impact that's going to have. And like, so I don't hear you addressing that issue. You're saying we can do this with the boutiques, we can do this with this, but that's only a small portion of the picture that I think that you guys were looking at.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that we didn't task them with doing a master plan of the whole site or looking at all of downtown.
Right.
We tasked them very specifically with these pieces of property.
But and when so, we ask them, we take away existing parking, then I would think it's important. You can't simply say, oh, well,
oh,
it has to be addressed. And so in that case, is why I'm saying I think they should have addressed it. Because that is a change from what even exists now.
We didn't ask them to, Dave.
So absent a master plan, which I think is difficult, a fallback position would be to say, all right, you have to absorb or build more parking for that use than that use mm-hmm. requires. In other words, if it was a boutique hotel needing 50 spots, then you have to come up with 100 spots underneath that boutique hotel or somewhere. At least then you're making a gain on it as opposed to saying manage it. Managing it is not going to work. It doesn't work right now.
I think the issue here is that we don't have those data.
Yeah.
And the stuff you're talking about is really in the implementation of a particular selection. So when you get to say, well, the most economically viable thing is a hotel, then you got to look at specifically at that project, and that's one step beyond what they're doing here. So in terms of what's the circulation and all that, that kind of gets beyond what's the best viable economic, social, job-producing use. So I think it's going to be done, but not under this contract. This.
I would add just to that point on parking, we analyzed a whole variety of uses and talked about it at two public work sessions. And one of the scenarios, and they because of, by design, we didn't include all of them in the final report and take them all the way through. But one thing that we did analyze was using the current surface parking lot that comes down along West Kingston as a major structured parking facility. In that case, I think we added a small restaurant function at one end, but generally it was a parking facility. The challenge with that and a couple of the other uses that we talked about and looked at was that is it's an investment for sure, but it's completely negative. It doesn't generate anywhere near enough revenue to be functional. And we specifically did that because of the fast ferry, because we know people are going to drive. Not everyone wants to take the bus. So that is a use that we consider, but through discussions with the community about downtown and about these properties in particular, we didn't take those forward. But you're right, that was an alternative, and we thought so too, so we've analyzed it. It's a major, I will say this, parking is a major, major, major cost. So an above-grade parking stall in an above-grade structure, which is the least expensive of doing this, we're talking $25,000 to $30,000 a stall if you're lucky, but low grade, 45,000 and up, and it's hard to make that pencil in places that have seen a ton of growth. So really, if the community wants to make that investment, you're gonna need to put that burden on a big, big geography and a lot of households, and it's gonna be a big community dialogue because it's a major investment for sure. And maybe Kitsap Transit doesn't. But.
To the parking question, yeah, here. One last thing, though, with respect to the usage that you have predicted here or proposed. One is that I can recall about 10 years ago that there were some parking considerations that there was not sufficient space for parking for a couple of things that were proposed for Washington Boulevard. One was the site I know of, the Kingston Inn, after it burned down, which I believe the Washington State Fair is eventually absorbed. But parking, my understanding, was the main reason that couldn't be used for any other purpose. Are those same constraints in place here on the Washington Boulevard development site?
Not as much, though. There's enough land to self-park some of these. The Washington Boulevard site, for example, has a grade where you could tuck parking underneath to provide some stalls to support that use. The two uses that we looked at, we'll jump ahead a little bit here, but two of the uses we looked at on the West Kingston site, one of which was the boat storage, that to support that use that kind of absorbs most of the parking that's currently there. But the cottage concept has parking on, you know, conceptually parking on the where the cottages would be, and it could possibly use some of the existing parking as overflow, but that existing parking would be part of the managed pool of the...
So we're just saying then that it is feasible to put parking on Washington Boulevard site, however, cost is going to be the primary concern.
That's very well put. Yes.
Well, you might have to do it like other developments do. You have to absorb some of that cost by the person that's enjoying the benefits. If it's a boutique hotel, they have to kick in for some of that cost of developing the parking. Are enjoying the benefits.
There's no question, and that's what we're doing, but that in, as soon as you do too much, it's going to make it negative, and we're not saying that that's good or bad, but that's just the way it works, and we didn't assume that that was going to be an investment that the public sector would eat. It's just we're showing the economic output is negative.
I'm assuming that we're talking about maybe a private-public partnership here that's going to enjoy the benefits of whatever commercial type development goes there.
Well, we'll talk about kind of the execution of that. So let's come back to the issue of how any one of these would be executed.
So, Betsy, and then we'll go back to
one last whip of the parking issue. I guess, listening to Dave's comments as well, I think the board, you know, now you're seeing and you have been thinking about, I know, the whole question of what you do with these two properties can't really be thought about in isolation. And obviously the parking for the new development that you may do and the displacement of the parking that you will achieve when you do new things on those two sites, I really urge the board to be thinking about the fact that there are other properties very, you know, accessible to the port that could perhaps be purchased and parking thought about, who knows, locations. The property that the property group owns right, you know, where the nail salon is. The county-owned parking facility or parking lot that I'm sure the transit folks are thinking about. There are parking solutions that are very easily at hand, but again, they well need to be part of this larger thought of not a full master plan, or you know, we get one, a way to address this parking issue because it is being exacerbated by anything between the coast. So,
thank you. So now you know parking.
It's a big deal.
In case you didn't.
It's always a big deal. I get it. All right. So shifting over to the potential uses. I'm glad to hear that a lot of people have had a chance to look this over. That's great. This section where we preview and talk about the four uses before we get into some of the more nuts and bolts and nuances from a developer's perspective, a user's perspective, and the port's perspective, we spent some time thinking about these four uses. So on West Kingston, it's the cottages concept and the rental cottages concept and a boat storage yard. And on the Washington Street site, it's the signature restaurant and the boutique hotel.
And that's why when the natural walkability, et cetera, was a big consideration in the focus groups, that no usage of any of the property for that purpose was proposed.
For
those two properties, nothing that would address the concern for getting to the shoreline, walkability, nature, enjoyment, etc.
The one of the benefits.
I mean, I understand it's probably not an economic plus, but.
No, one of the key parts to say, for example, the cottages, rental cottages concept is to basically open up that waterfront so that it can be utilized by the public and also be a benefit to the short-term cottage renters. So that is absolutely an important part. Security is very important for boat storage. So either, you know, and boat storage wouldn't be done on the waterfront. So again, another a use that would be compatible with opening up that shoreline. And
just a comment on that. The buffer zone's 50 feet wide. that would be a nice waterfront trail. So that land is already non-buildable, and any developer, we could ensure that they preserve the public access to that. And you can put sidewalks and buffer zones and ways down to the water, so you'd probably need an access over by Bath Barrett. But, you know, so that could be built into any of the projects, as far as I
see.
Yeah,
in every case, it's a real opportunity on the waterfront,
for sure.
Yeah. So looking at the cottage rentals concept, this is basically a lower impact hospitality play. Some of the benefits to this are it's can be done in a very attractive manner, but at a lower cost. The parking that can support the site can be done, you know, on the surface. Roughly, I think it's a one stall per unit. The existing home that is on the property could be used as well for that, for the use of the lodge as either a gathering space for the lodge, sign in, maybe a small restaurant, something like that. There's an opportunity to actually leverage the asset that's in place. It's an interesting market as well. It's actually, there's not a lot of players in the cottage, specifically cottage rental market. There's been a couple of more innovative projects, one on Vashon Island that has done very well. It's been up and running now for probably 8 months, so it's still proving out, but they've been very successful. You know, and then you look at the Port Campbell project, and that's on some older buildings, but they're just smaller buildings. But they get very impressive rental rates, which help the feasibility of them. You look at this site, and it's right on the waterfront. It actually is a superior site to a lot of the ones that we kind of looked at here in terms of its waterfront orientation, access to downtown, and, of course, walkability. We actually were just ruminating on the site for this meeting.
I kind of like to play with spreadsheets, you know, because that's what engineers types do. So when I looked at the rental rates and I did a standard deviation to the average, I came up with a rental range of 151 to 271, which is considerably below what you put there. I'm just talking about the samples that you provided.
No,
so am I missing something here?
No. That's kind of I think that's more of a peak pricing range that we see on this property. Mm-hmm. And the model we ran on our numbers, we actually used 180. 200.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
I did 200.
That's the average.
Blended annual.
That's the average, yeah.
Yeah, blended average annual.
Okay.
But they're getting more than that at Vashon.
Oh, okay.
Blended average.
Like I said, has anybody been to Roach lately? Just those small little cottages that are over 100 years old, they get $450 a night.
Yeah.
And you have to walk down and up to get to the bathroom. But I'm serious, you have to list.
Yeah,
and
we have just paid bathrooms.
Yeah, no, it's, if you get a good reputation, people will pay.
The concept too here was it's a scale and we're not presuming how it ultimately gets assigned, but the word cottage kind of suggested it. One of the things we like about this is it gets visitors who are staying two or three nights. It gets them downtown. A big part of what we heard from the community was, you know, getting people downtown that are going to go to the restaurants, and more people spending money in shops and restaurants begets more shops and restaurants for people who live here. So we like the idea. We're really working hard to find an economic way to introduce some, you know, visitors and capture the dollars that they would spend, you know, on a holiday. And this, because it's, as Matt points out, is a lower cost than a staff flat hotel. It doesn't have the same fixed costs or operating costs. It's an opportunity that we think has economic legs if it was desirable, you know, at the end of the day, by the port.
A question. One thing that I've become aware of since we have a trailer is that RV parks are having a fully hookup RV park, and then they have the cottages as well along the side. Have you considered at all a fully equipped RV park here? Because there is none.
We definitely talked about it, and you actually can see that in a number of different places, because it's, and if it's, even without the full hookups, it's pretty easy to set up, right? So it's kind of, and it makes good money. I mean, the per stall rate, you know, $40 compared to the capital costs
to create it. It's kind of an easy moneymaker for the property owner at the end of the day. So it came up and we talked about it, but this was more of, I think this was thought to be more in keeping to achieve kind of the same hospitality impact. But there's really no reason why RV couldn't work there, and it could also be on a more temporary basis. So if the port was to decide we're just not ready to do anything expensive and permanent, or we don't want to put it under a ground lease to a developer just yet, you could easily amortize the you know horizontal infrastructure costs of RV over a short period of time, and it would make for a fine investment. I think the challenge with RV parks is, I mean, they work for all the reasons I just said. The challenge is some people don't like the way they look. They say, now you got a bunch of trailers on our waterfront. And that's just the way it is. I mean, the RVs, what are you going to do?
If it was limited in time, you can't be there any longer than 7 days. You're not dealing with, and that's the way it should be even with the cottages. So
even if it was just 3 days, I mean, you're still, let's presume that we're 95% full all the time because we're running it really well. You're still going to have 95%.
I'm just thinking about baby boomers. You know, they're now starting to retire, and I don't know if you've noticed it, but on the highways there are a ton of RVs, and whether they're RV buses or trailer tag-alongs, fifth wheels or what have you, and they are not little 16-footers.
And they're expensive. There's a lot of spenders going on. So if they go up here, we go to the restaurant. And I think it gets to some of the same spillover that I did.
Okay.
The second point is you should be looking at the revenue per square foot, whether it's a cottage home or parking or RV or whatever. And when you do that, and when you consider the port now gets about $180 a stall, if somebody rents that car, that spot out every day, private guys are getting $50 a month per stall here. You extrapolate that out and you can see that a parking structure, even at $20,000 a stall, is still a positive return. So, again, absent a master plan, you got to get some facts, and you got to be looking at what the port can do that other people can't.
Okay. So I want to move on with this, and we'll have an opportunity for more questions, comments, as we go on.
It's a good segue into dry stack boat storage.
Yeah, so the other option that we considered for the West Kingston site was dry stack boat storage, which currently, based on a survey that we did throughout the Puget Sound area, is relatively absent on any level of scale in Kitsap County. That's looking at the major cities that are adjacent to the water. Throughout the more eastern side of the Puget Sound, it's very prevalent and also in high demand, specifically around Lake Washington, which is not surprising, but then also over in Edmonds, not too far away. They are fully booked right now. And you can see a number, number 10 on the chart, that their rates are strong in relative fashion to the rest of the region. They're getting $350 a month for their boat stalls. And this is for an average slip of about 33 or 35 foot boat. So not small boats, and very similar to the boats that come through Kingston quite frequently. And so there could be an opportunity there. And we also see that the aesthetics are going to be a big consideration, once again, because this is adjacent to your downtown. And you're not going to want to look at a monolithic aluminum shiny structure that seagulls are going to nest all over. You know, you don't want that.
You may not want that.
Maybe you do.
We don't want that for you.
Yeah, we don't want that for you. So those are additional costs there. To further address the parking consideration, there will also be an offset of stalls that are in place through the pursuit of this plan. So this would take up a number of stalls that are contributing to port revenue. And so that's an important consideration that could be looked at further as well. Another consideration of this program would be the slope of the site. It's pretty significant, and so that adds to the construction costs of grading and then also supporting the hillside. So go ahead.
Well, how about the environmental issues? Because those outdrives or any of those big boats, because I've got one, and I'll tell you something right now. The issue is, especially on outdrives, if the sun hits the side on one side and the cold hits the other, you're going to get an oil drip, period. And as close as that is to the water, and the problems they've had with that water in the past, it's taken forever to clean that up, and it's still not clean. And you're going to get runoff, period. You're going to get runoff. I don't care what you guys say. You're going to get runoff from pollution in that area.
Yeah, so...
And a lot of the people come here now, excuse me, but they're people that are kayaking, they're paddleboarding, there's kids coming down. People from Seattle are catching on that they can go to the fast ferry and come here, one of the few ports in the whole Puget Sound that can happen that way. And to have that happening is not a good scenario. And the environmental issue is going to be huge on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that would probably fall on the developer or the operator to have a system where they're capturing on site. So it's additional cost that would be built in to the program, but that's a huge concern. And what we looked at was having fully enclosed, controlled dry stack storage versus open air, and that's desirable in the market. That's reflected in the rates that we showed. So that's the program right there. What we looked at was that the port would ground lease the site and then would have an operator come in and do the development and then also manage the facility.
Just a comment on that, which these guys know it's coming anyway. I was interested in this because one thing we're supposed to be looking at stuff that produces working people, and this could result in marine businesses and such. So this, the intent of the CURB program is to be job production. So, you know, that other than service jobs. So some things I found out. One is if you do three high and you do about 240 boats, you can absorb the parking on the footprint that you currently have, so you don't have to intrude into the other parking lot. The other thing is cutting into the slope lowers the height of the stack, so you can do a three-stack storage where you're probably only having one boat above the street level visual, so that mitigates the impact. So the idea of the port already has all the front office stuff, and we do have staff. So the idea that we would bring a contractor in to run it seems to be not an efficient use of our resources. That's the business we're in. We know how to do it. I think we could do it with one FTE because we got everything else, you know. So anyway, when I did those numbers with the port owning it, I had a problem with the NPV analysis because it really didn't have a salvage value at the end. So 10 years, it's hard. Well, actually, it might be worth more in 10 years than it is at year one. So I ran it out to 30 years, and I realized that type of analysis kind of is difficult at 30 years, and I admitted that to you. So I did the analysis of all the costs, port ownership, and it's by far the biggest earner of all the projects when you run it out, the length of the structure. You know, so you take out a loan, 30-year loan, and expend everything at the end of 30 years. So I gave them the spreadsheets, and I can give you a copy. But it is a good, from the standpoint of CURB, generating revenue for job-related stuff, even though it's indirect jobs, you know. So I just wanted to point that out there, and that's a challenge with these type of analysis. ROA, NPV, net earnings, they all kind of give you different answers. So I can give you those notes.
That would be great.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we'll, like, Commissioner, we'll go back and revisit that because I think you're right about the terminal value piece. It won't change the cash on cash return projection, but it will affect the NPV substantially, so we'll make that modification.
Yeah. This is just the first page. You don't want all 30 years, do you?
Bruce, you going to say something?
Yeah, just a question for Walt. When you were talking about the CURB effect,
yeah,
and the indirect job creation, you're thinking that a facility like that would encourage development of independent businesses in the community that would feed off of that, such as boat repair.
Yeah, that's kind of what I meant, is maritime trades. Someone mentioned that earlier, yeah.
Okay.
Sort of the Edmonds effect, even though they have the land, they have dealers and repair shops and those type of things.
Okay.
Can I ask a question?
can I just ask a basic question? How does it work? I understand the storage component, but to be able to get the boat down, you've got to have that equipment, those slings that take the boat down and move it around at all?
You do it with a forklift.
Really?
But you know, now you're getting the details of the project. Is that feasible to do here? I don't know.
Right, that,
so I just kind of use their numbers.
But it sounded like you were saying that you already have all the equipment,
other
types of equipment and other maneuvering and all that stuff involved.
We would need to buy the equipment, and have the operators.
I think what I took from what Commissioner Elliott was saying is that we have the essentially organizational infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera.
No, that makes good sense.
It was more like, why would you outsource it when you already have the front office functions staffed? That was the point. Yeah,
good point.
Yeah,
I was thinking of big slings over it.
Yeah.
I think the only reason you would do that is if you didn't have the capacity to make the upfront investment.
Take a loan out. One thing we would need probably is an RCO grant for a washdown pad, which addresses the issue there, because you're going to wash down the boats before you stack them, and that's something that you really need a good facility to make sure you're capturing everything that comes off that boat. Yeah. So, even if it's shaded.
The difference between Edmonds and here, because I live in Edmonds, you've got the railroad tracks, you have got the flat land, you've got a lot of room, and personally, if you've been in down there, they've kind of ruined that the beach side. I mean, a lot of people can't even get in there anymore.
Yeah.
And it doesn't look good. I mean, nobody goes down to visit the port. Mm. They go there if they have boats, and they might go to Arnie's, but basically, as far as traffic flow, forget it. I mean, you don't have people going and viewing the beach there. And they've ruined the beach there because they've got it stacked up, and on the weekends, it's a mess. It is a mess because those port lifts have to move those big, they're in cranes. They have to pick up the frame and move it and then pick it up onto the thing, and it's miles and miles of trying to get those boats in the water with the lift.
Have to
think about the lift.
I think the port over its history has done a real great job preserving the waterfront no matter what we do. You know, I remember when they used to have the pits and the boatyard and all, we got to live up to what our commissioners handed off to us, a quality waterfront. And, no matter what we do, we're going to have to keep that in any project.
Can I have my speaking time now since I signed it?
Sure.
First, I'd like to thank the court commissioners for allowing this meeting to be interactive. The last time I was at the court meeting, you spoke at the beginning, and then that was it. There was no kind of progress of, back and forth exchange. So I really appreciate that that's going on today. Number two, real quick, in looking as I did before I came to the meeting, I'd like to express one woman's opinion not to have a bunch of stacking car boats on the currently the parking lot property. Number three, like the cottage idea, we'll let that sort. I just, as an aside, want to let you know that I do try to stay up with what meetings are going on, even though I'm trying to swear off attending them. And I was not aware of the two community input meetings, so I'm sitting here feeling like, how did I miss that? Because I would have loved to have come. So, and I only by chance knew about this. And given the small number, even though it's a 1 o'clock meeting, not an evening meeting, but a small number of people here, I'm sure there's a much larger interest. So I'd love to strongly encourage the port to keep doing wider advertising of these public comment meetings and just support you with that. Finally, I'd like to say that as someone who regularly walks into Kingston from my home, does a formal loop, one of the things that's very important to me, and I've been here almost 30 years, about Kingston, is that the downtown area of Kingston feels very open, visually open. And I know there are many business owners and property owners who have a lot more money than I do who want to see a lot of development in downtown Kingston. And I fully understand that it's an urban core. But I want to encourage
the port to the degree that you do projects in downtown Kingston, to keep in mind that what is appealing and attractive and charming about Kingston, I'm sure you heard this in the two meetings you had, is this feeling of openness, that there are 3, 4, and 5-story buildings all crammed up against each other throughout the downtown core, and that that is something special to try and hang on to if at all possible. And issues like parking and more restaurants and, you know, more economic development, more, okay? Many of us don't necessarily favor more. So I hope that those of us who don't favor more will be heard and respected as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so moving over to the Washington Boulevard site.
May I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Since we're on West Kingston Road, when you briefed the public, you had a residential development option. And I'm curious why we didn't include that, since that seems to be most keeping with the zoning and probably maybe the least commercial impact on the neighborhood. So was there a reason why it wasn't included, or is that viable?
Actually, long term, we do believe it's viable, especially with the changing demographics in the Fast Ferry. It could be for rent, or we were considering condos for this site. One of the considerations against it was the long term intentions of the port's use of the property as a maritime type use or something that's more economic development related. The most likely structure would be a ground lease structure for this site, and apartment developers might have, or condo builders might have a difficult time with that structure in this area where there's other opportunities around. So for example, the OPG site, there's a couple other sites where multifamily would make a lot of sense. And so for those reasons, we had room to analyze, two on each site. We wanted to do the dry boat and the cottage for this site, and leave the multifamily for one of the other market sites that could be supportive of it.
Maybe just to put a finer point to it, at today's rents that you could prove, that density of for rent housing isn't viable. So it's given that we did look at it and we messed with it, it's really non-economic and it's really not something that the port would do. But if you were to surplus the site, for example, which ports do occasionally decide the asset is no longer needed in the portfolio, and you were to sell it, some private sector might consider that, but it really wants to be a for sale product economically in today's dollars, and it wants to be much lower density than a 3 or 4 story residential. So we gave it we played with it, but it's
and this was the thing you showed us.
That
thing you showed the community.
I think people were pretty fired up about it.
Yeah, it was. It were. That's why I was surprised.
And everybody was pretty unhinged about the density.
Oh, okay.
That's not the reason we didn't do it, because we're exploring it. But it was for all the other reasons about the port's mission and the property and so forth that it wasn't really deemed a necessary thing for that. And the aquatic, you may recall the Aquatic Center Beach Club, which was one of my personal favorites, also got dropped off the truck for a variety of reasons, including giant cost and so on and so forth.
Before we leave the West Kingston site, and I'll also give you a nice segue into the Washington Boulevard site too, I take it you didn't consider the West Kingston Road property for the Signature Waterfront restaurant. Was that because of the zoning, or were there other reasons? And then the second half, here's the handoff. If you did consider that, you had the 4 factors of feasibility and impact and that you consider for each of those sites. You had those considerations for a waterfront signature restaurant on the Washington Boulevard site. Would any of those change if you were putting the restaurant over on the West Kingston Road site?
Yeah, I don't think they changed significantly. Going back to the last iterations of the concepts, one of them was on the West Kingston site, a large-scale parking garage. And on top of that parking garage, towards the east end, would have been a signature restaurant overlooking the water and the downtown skyline and the Seattle skyline. You also have the existing
building, which, while the building itself on the West Kingston site would not be suitable for a signature restaurant, it could be used for, at least in part, a destination restaurant that is waterfront and very interesting to enjoy this portion of the building. So I don't think those lenses we looked at, the marketability, feasibility, and impact, would change dramatically between the two sites. They're in a sense, interchangeable from that respect. But personally, I believe the West Kingston site is, or rather the Washington Boulevard site, is a little stronger for a waterfront signature restaurant just because of its direct adjacency to the terminal. It has a more commanding view looking towards downtown and Mount Rainier, and it spills over down into the park.
Just to throw one other thing at it, the signature restaurant idea on the West Kingston site, because it's much bigger, it would cost less. So there would be a benefit to that. I mean, if you were to park it at, say, 8 per thousand, which is a pretty typical restaurant, major restaurant parking ratio, it'd be all surface. It wouldn't displace any existing parking. So certainly from that standpoint, it would be easier to do there. So it's pretty subjective. I mean, you can do it there. It also doesn't conform with the zoning, but a lot of what we're looking at doesn't conform with the zoning. So I don't know that I would consider that to be a huge limitation.
Yeah, it just seemed to me if you did a restaurant there, you've got a built-in event site right next door with what is now just a park area.
Sure.
So there's an expanded capacity for use, and it would very easily blend into a public access along the waterfront there. Plus the fact that you can come back a bit farther from the water with your development, and some of that then gets outside of that 250-foot buffer zone.
Yeah.
The same questions as using that site, West Kingston Road, for a boutique hotel. Because you're already talking about some lodging, and at one time this idea of getting a little hotel and then a convention center, well, the access to the meeting rooms that we're in right now. So is that interchangeable?
I think it would be similar to the restaurant of the West Kingston, just because of the more generous, palette on which to paint. I think it would be an easier project. What does the profile really, and this is partially in order to pull off this, to implement these ideas on either one, you're going to have to get, especially on the hotel, you're going to get respondents, hoteliers are going to respond.
Right.
Then, and they're going to judge in their view kind of which property they like the best. So, but I think a lot of our analysis would be interchangeable and potentially less costly.
It seems like a more benign impact in the neighborhood to have a hotel instead of a restaurant. And then a hotel with a lot of congestion and concerts and all that sort of stuff around it has more external interference. But anyway, it seemed like a less impact on the neighborhood than another commercial operation.
Yeah.
Cool. Quick question: that old house on the Washington. Once you plow that down, you have to move 200 feet back. Am I correct? So that's in the grandfather clause. You're out of luck. You're going to have to go back. I don't know if you people are aware of that or not. But that's the new law now. Anything off the shoreline, they could remodel what's there and keep it on the water.
Remodel.
Yes, you can remodel what's there.
That's right.
But if you tear it down, you have to move back.
Yeah, you want to be absolutely yes to all that, and you would want to investigate fully whether the change of use from, say, residential to commercial. As part of the remodel, if that kicked you out of that as well. But ideally, if you've got FAR or a floor area that you can't recreate, then you really think hard before you tear it down. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Great segue. Thank you. We're at Washington Boulevard site and a boutique hotel concept. So the idea here is a two-story concept, 10 to 15 units. The first floor would have some units, the second floor would be fully populated with units. There could be a small retail component to the ground floor, along with a small check-in area, things like the lobby and whatnot. The opportunity here is that there is not a lot of waterfront hospitality plays locations in Kitsap County. You have a fast ferry, Despite what the HBS report stated a couple of years ago, that hotels are challenging, the economics still are relatively challenging, but the dynamics have changed. With visitor stays, you could be doing some business retreats fairly easily here, small, you know, C-suite type, small conferences possibly, if you had a little ground floor meeting room integrated within this. So it's really, I think it could be programmed very interestingly and compelling to support the change that should be arriving with the fast ferry. It would be competing with, in large part, some projects, the projects in Port Gamble, to a lesser degree, the casino, but in large part, the Airbnb kind of shadow market of hospitality as well. But it's a superior location. It would be a superior location. Walk on, walk off, be right there to check in, walk across the street to some restaurants. Going back to our visioning here, concept testing community meeting, we did have a concept that was even more intensive with three stories and a signature restaurant integrated within there. That was a little too big of an apple to bite into. This is probably a little more manageable, which is why we scaled it down a little bit. It would need to be self-parked, going back to the parking questions, so that that might be challenging. We'd have to take a closer look at the how the parking would lay out on the site and whether or not you can fit enough stalls in there. Our initial look is that it could be done, so that's important, an important finding. What that doesn't allow for, that brings parking down at the park level. So instead of use spilling out into the park, it's a parking lot spilling out into the park as you've got it today. So it could potentially be missed opportunity to help activate that park even more with roll-up shed type use on that park.
You mean the beer tent would go away? The beer tent would go away.
We turn into a tailgate deal. in short, that's the kind of opportunity that's there. The considerations really were that the 2015 study showed that hotels were pretty far out. We believe that game has changed a little bit. We feel that there will be demand coming from across the Sound. Seasonality is also a potential challenge, but again, you're in a position where you're a half-hour ferry ride away from a pool of users that could use the rooms for a meeting space and small conferences during the winter months as a bit of a getaway. We did that with a site on Vashon, so why not Kingston?
We really have to look at that very carefully and consider in relationship to this building.
Well, it would be a different scale, but yeah, it's nowhere near the scale. The caveat on boutique hotels always, especially as they get smaller, it gets just more and more difficult to make them pencil operationally.
I had a question with that.
Pretty common, everybody.
Yeah, you showed a 200-250 room rate, but if I take the average and go up and down one sigma, I get 98 to 200.
Yeah.
So this is really at the low probability, that room rate is at the low, you got already got like 80% of the potential room rates based on this below what you're showing.
Yeah.
So this is a room rate that would be in the upper 20% of this market.
Yeah.
So I was kind of concerned about that.
We used 100 in the actual modeling. We used 180 as the seasonal average, year-round average. This is, again, kind of the more peak rate. But, again, the type of user would help drive that rate potentially, but it is in this range that's being showed right there is relative to the comp set.
Okay, so the 200-250 rate is well up there.
Yeah,
it's way above your what you were planning on.
And you also look at the room counts there. We're talking 10 to 15 rooms versus the range of room counts here. You have in order to make this even come close, you're going to have to drive room rates. Because you're only, you compare this to the cottage one where we've got, 25 rooms that cost $125K to build versus 10 to 15 that are on a per room count or over that because of the parking. You're going to need that revenue to be challenging.
Dave?
Now, how many units are you talking about? 10?
10 to 15, yeah. Small.
The stakeholders had a consultant look at a hotel concept for Kingston and prior to the Point Casinos Hotel. And basically, they came to the conclusion that you have to be at about 35 units to make it pencil. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's a mom and pop operation, mm-hmm. owner operator type of people. So I agree.
Is that
with
for the hotel?
Yeah, 35 stuff too. Yeah, there's a scenario there. If this was really desirable and you really wanted, the port really wanted to test this, you could engage with boutique hoteliers from around the region. Host them, get their feedback. You could even issue an RFP if you wanted to go the distance and get that interest, and then find out at that moment in time. They like the site, they're going to say nice things about Kingston, but ultimately they can't put the money into it, and you don't want to, so it goes away. So there's ways you could test it if you really wanted to understand whether you can make it fly or not.
Well, I think that the cottages are competing for a different market. That's probably families and the kids want to go paddling or something.
Totally.
Here you're almost going head-to-head with the casinos, and they have the ability to have the gambling and the hotel rooms support each other.
And
so it seems like
scale,
yeah, and this got scale. So I understand cottages competing, but I don't see how, unless we had a drop dead killer attraction here, I don't see how we would compete with something that's 20 minutes away.
Agreed.
It's
challenged for sure. It's a challenging scenario. We agree. Okay. All right.
So the next option for the Washington Boulevard site is on page 21, and it is what we're referring to as the signature water-oriented restaurant. Throughout Puget Sound, we're all familiar with these. Arnie's, as we mentioned earlier, Anthony's, Elliot's down in Seattle, Duke's as well. So as of right now, Kingston is absent of a restaurant of this quality and of this regional proudness, if you will. And this is a big opportunity because the site has incredible views of the Cascades, of Rainier, Seattle skyline, of the ferry terminal coming in, and whatnot. So that's a big attraction, and also an opportunity to capture some of the ferry traffic that, as of right now, is flowing through the city, and it can keep those individuals in town. Also, with the fast ferry, it's pretty attractive to think about the potential of hopping on with your family or your significant other on in Seattle and going to Kingston for dinner and coming back or whatnot, or on the weekend and visiting a restaurant of this esteem. Considerations is, once again, it's parking, and restaurants require parking. So figuring out that viability, and then the structure of how this would work would be the port to ground lease to an operator who would do all the development and then manage the facility. There are specific restaurants that are looking, and Kingston could be this next site, and I think that it's well poised, and right now it's absent in the market. So.
Can I follow up on something you said about the ground lease to an operator? One alternative to that would be the port maybe building the shell so that the port would own the building, an operator would provide all the TIs and everything. How would the feasibility of that project change under that kind of scenario?
In that scenario, every time you invest, hard dollars, actual construction dollars, you're taking some chance that it's not going to be appreciated on a dollar-for-dollar basis by that operator. So, for example, in order to get there, you'd have to build that shell, and you'd have to have a lot of confidence. That's exactly what what you have in mind is, and you build is exactly what the restaurateur wants.
I guess I'd be thinking more of a build to suit.
Yeah, so that's where I was going to go. So the way to hedge that bet is to offer it up as a build to suit. So, and you would do just that. You would do the shell and core, and you would negotiate a lease all in advance of spending hard dollars, and you would agree to the design. You go, we're just doing this with the Port of Seattle right now. It's not a restaurant. It's a retail and warehouse building, but it's the same process. Yeah, and that mitigates a lot of the risk you just have to spend money. So if you're willing to spend the money to build the shell and core, and they're going to build the TIs, which are expensive for restaurants, very expensive. So if they're willing to bring the TI dollars into that project, and then you negotiate rent, you know, based on the shell and core, that would be.
Seems to me that might be, you know, we're putting a little more skin in the game. They're putting a little less skin in the game. That might get more fish biting for our proposal with that kind of
thing. It very well may. A lot of restaurateurs right now, and this is it seems odd, but in a lot of the kind of booming urban neighborhoods around the Puget Sound, those really good sought after restaurant operators, they're not even willing to do the TIs. So they kind of like, it's great. If you build it, I'll operate it, and I'll pay you the rent for it, but I'm not even going to bring the capital to it. So it is a fine line because they're in demand in mixed use projects because they do change the dynamics of the overall. So it's something to consider. But it could be, again, that's a scenario that could, without a huge expense, be tested in the market. And then you can always decide, wow, don't like the responses, don't like what we're hearing, the numbers aren't looking the way we want them to, and then you could cease that. So.
Ron, did you have a comment?
I did. This is kind of a favorite subject of mine. Are you prepared to give us the financial analysis between a ground lease and if the port was willing to take the risk? There's always a risk, but there's usually more reward for that.
Sure.
That's the first question. And the second one, if someone came in here in the next couple of weeks and offered a ground lease for a 3,500-foot restaurant with the parking, which is about 17 lots, mm-hmm. is the port ready to consider that, or do we have to go through a competitive bid process to get to that if they were comfortable with whoever wanted to make that ground lease? That's two questions.
It is. I'll answer the first one, but the second one is really a question to the commission.
Goes with that. As a lawyer here.
to your first question, the financial model? Yes, absolutely. We showed it as a ground lease, but it's not difficult to just convert the shell and core and then show what the potential rent.
Can you do that? Because other courts have told me that a building to suit lease is a whole lot better for the public, and if the port's willing to take that risk, the financial analysis and the difference is a very key factor.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah.
You have the ports are wrong.
No, that is, I mean, it can go both ways. I mean, that's really the execution. You can do the ground lease, you can sell it.
So which is best? Which would fit us? Because I think...
Well, I think that's a fair question to the commission. I don't want to freeze the answer.
And Jim, can you address the question about whether or not as I understand what you're suggesting, Ron, someone comes to us with a proposal, do we need to say thank you, pause, and go for competitive?
No, this has been tested through a couple of our lawyers. But we wouldn't. We could negotiate in good faith with you. So if you'd like to come in next week, I'd be happy to talk to you about
it. I'm serious.
I'm serious, too.
That may well happen.
I would love to do that.
People are excited about this past Berry thing.
I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, I just kind of have one thing, which is maybe on the next segment, but we looked at feasibility, but we didn't really touch on what is the risk of the project, the risk of the project achieving its business objectives relative. You know, some of them I think are very low risk. Some of them, maybe like a restaurant, can be higher risk. And I didn't get a sense for that because that's a factor in deciding on which way to go. And,
Well, let me talk about that a little bit. There's risk in all of these projects, clearly. A lot of it is in how you execute it. It's a good segue to this question, and that's why I would defer to the commission to answer the question of what exactly, how you're going to structure it. So a ground lease, you put the land in, and you negotiate a return on that land value as is condition. Right? It's the lowest risk real estate investment anyone ever does. It's why university endowments and nonprofits who really want long-term cash flow, they'll do that, right? So the risk to the port in that case is de minimis, especially after the improvements are finished. So if I build a warehouse on your land and then I miss my payment to you as the lessee, you get to foreclose on my building. Now, it never happens. If there's a bank loan in place, they always step in. But the idea is it's virtually risk-free at that point on the ground lease. But mm-hmm. if you go the distance and you build, say we do step up the next level of risk to a build-to-suit, and I build this shell and core, and you don't put in a whole lot of TIs, depending on what type of building that is, and then you go bankrupt, then it's the same amount of risk that I take on as a developer, except at least going into it, I didn't take up lease-up risk because I had my tenant, but they went bankrupt, they walked away, now I got to go find a tenant. So there's some maybe more risk there. The most risk then, the highest, would be you go into town and building a 3,500 square foot restaurant and decking it all out and then going to look for a restaurateur to operate it would be the most risk in that case.
I was really, I was thinking another dimension. That the rest, these are all single purpose type uses. You can move the cottages, but we got a boat out there that's still not disposed of. If a restaurateur builds a restaurant and goes out of business, that's still on our property. We lift it. We can't move our port to some other place in Kitsap County. So that's the kind of these businesses' ability to succeed.
Sure.
You know, in the business that they are. I'm kind of wondering about that risk, that some of these are probably sure shots. Some of these are probably riskier. I don't know if there's any
variance. Yeah, restaurants have real thin margins, and they're tough. So there's no question about that. I'd be most worried about that. You're just talking about the go dark risk.
Yeah, yeah.
And that means means it may not hit you financially because you get the improvements, maybe, that are depending on how it's structured. But just the bigger issue of just it's a tough business, and if they go dark, what do you do next? And can a restaurant survive? And that's really the business economics. You're going to get responses as you mm-hmm. proceed to find someone, and they're going to be able to better assess the restaurant risk. So if you talk to a restaurateur, for example, you know, they look hard at it, they look at the other restaurants, but they're also a certain type of restaurateur. So they'll sit down and say, well, I'm a full service restaurant guy. I do higher end stuff. So I know that I have to turn tables on this pace and I can only afford this kind of staff. And they look at their own metrics. And if somebody else, it could be a more casual restaurant, they may have a different formula. Certainly Anthony's has made a whole business out of being kind of on waterfronts, and so they've got that their own model. So there's a fair amount of risk to it, but I don't think I could tell you, you know, uniformly what restaurant
to run. I guess what I'm hearing is as long as we're dealing with a developer that's well-experienced and well-staffed for all of these projects, whether it's a boutique hotel, the cottage industry, or a restaurant, then they can do a credible risk assessment. We might be a little thinner water if we're dealing with some person that doesn't have that
absolutely
in-house capability to do that.
And so it's more towards the end of this when we're talking about kind of that marketing process, but that's just like any transaction. That's where you're evaluating the other side to make sure that they have the capacity and the experience to deliver. And that gets you so far. The rest of it, you make sure in your transaction structure that your downside is as protected as you can be. So you know, for example, we always test questions of what if they go bankrupt? What if they go bankrupt during construction? What if they go bankrupt 5 years down the road? How bad is that for us? And if you can live with those answers, then, you know, you've mitigated the risk the best you can.
Nancy, Ron, Kathy.
So another risk is our friendly put there in the room that is on everyone's mind. And Kitsap Transit may be able to accomplish something that the last two goes at the Foot Ferry weren't able to accomplish, which is that when the winter is nasty and the boats don't run, and the boat didn't run, and, you know, maybe their boat will run, but in the dead of winter and nasty storm, how many people want to go to the effort to go to downtown Seattle and get on a boat to go to our Anthony's as opposed to the one right in their own neighborhood? The other thing is that at the current time, those foot ferries are commuter ferries. There isn't a schedule yet for evenings, weekends, for those of us who might want to use that boat for social rather than work reasons. So that's a high risk too. Just saying.
Ron?
Thank you. There's a risk in doing a ground lease or build-to-suit, and I understand Walt's position because that's the least risky, but things have changed, and I think it's largely a public input to the court to say how much risk we're willing to take. And when we have some great commissioners and a great executive, and I'll let what kind of advice would you give them to be able to make that choice in the coming year. I mean,
I thought
what can they do? I mean, this is a complicated problem.
Which part of it is the complicated?
Making the decision where you want to do a ground lease for this financial thing, or you build a suit, and this is the financial, and here's the risk. How are they going to make that decision? Do they need, I don't know. If I was sitting up there, I wouldn't have a clue how to make that decision. I'm a risk taker, but it's probably my
other side. Okay, so it's a fair question. I'll start with the key differences. So the ground lease doesn't require very much money. So a lot of groups say, I'm land rich, I'm cash poor, this is my option. So they would choose, you choose that scenario. It's not really a matter of risk, it's just that I don't have the cash to do anything else. Maybe I also don't have the expertise, and I don't want to do that. The next step up from that, we mentioned build a suit. Well, you've got to be ready to build to suit, which means you have to finance the balance of that. And if you've hit your bonding limit, or you've got other things you want to do with that capacity, then maybe that's too much risk. So, that's a question we have not had with the commission. We've not talked about the how the books look in that context yet. And you know, for example, a hotel. You know, how far down the road do you go with a hotel? And I would suggest, I mean, my advice, given the challenges that we see just with the basic market, is that you wouldn't go any farther than a ground lease. That's really got to be on the hotelier, and they're going to have to deliver the capital. And I wouldn't take it a lot further than that. If nobody wants to show up and do it the way the community would accept, then I would say, okay, let's move on or just wait. So I think it depends on the product types. The boat storage, I mean, I, to Commissioner Elliott's point, is a maritime use. Ports operate marinas. You already operate a marina. I think that's a much for your operational purposes. If the community likes that addition to the downtown, then that's a much lower risk thing. Because of your expertise and your abilities and your maybe operational efficiencies, you can do it better, and you've got the capacity to pay for it. Maybe that's something you take all the way through and operate and own 100% of. So I think it varies by product type, for sure. But it really, from this, and this goes to the question of next steps, is, you know, the court and the community thinking about, you know, what of the things we've talked about really resonate and are going to help downtown Kingston, are going to match with the port's mission, and then looking at those and then going the next step in terms of implementation.
Kathy and then Dave.
We've talked about a lot of aspects of the proposal, but if you were to consider, you made a distinction earlier between a signature restaurant and a destination restaurant. You were to consider factors. First of all, could you define destination or distinguish between those two types of restaurants? And secondly, if you were to consider feasibility and risk and some of the other factors we've been talking about, are there any way to, is there any particular differences between those two types of restaurants that would make some significant difference in the amount of risk or feasibility of the proposal?
Yeah, let me clarify my destination versus signature. It was in reference to the existing house. So a signature restaurant is an established restaurateur. The signature part of it also is its location, prominence within the community and the, you know, views it commands and things like that. Destination probably wasn't the best descriptor for it. This would be, especially on that, repurposing that house for a restaurant, it would be a destination in that its location is strong. It would probably be a little more, you know, quirky feel because it's rehabbing a house and turning it into a restaurant. And by default, then it wouldn't have the same kind of shine necessarily.
So you weren't using the term destination regarding the Washington property.
They both would be destinations. By default, the signature restaurant is a destination restaurant.
Yeah, we were probably using it loosely and interchangeably. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Dave, did that answer what you were after, Kathy? That got you away.
Yes, thanks.
It just kind of goes through like there's competing risk here. There's the risk the developer looks at a project. The developer like Anthony's isn't going to take a ground lease unless we're in a super market location. So they're going to look at whoever we are, what will you do? They're going to want to see how far, how much money and how far we go to reduce their risk. So you can't go out there and say you're going to get a ground lease and we're going to get Anthony's. That ain't gonna happen. So
just offer something on public-private partnerships. Some ports do this all the time. This is new for us. And for us to have, I mean, Jim's a great guy, but there's ports that are staffed up that can do partnerships and execute that. We could hire that talent and Jim can work it. But for us, getting into a more complex arrangement would be a difficult first step for our first development project. At least that's my perspective. So I'd be thinking more, but how simple can we make it? Because even the simple is complex in this business, in which we don't have a lot of experience.
Commissioner McClure, this is compelling and I appreciate it. I have to be in Paul's Bow for a 4 o'clock meeting, so probably need to be around 3:30. So
excellent. So we'll make your report next, okay. And I think we're pretty much on the verge of finishing this up. Is that correct?
Just one comment on what we're talking about there, and I appreciate Commissioner Elliott's comment that this is new territory for us. It's new for the community. We have ways of financing things, you know, such as you alluded to bonding or levies or whatever. Any of that would go up in cost to us as we would go, you know, from ground lease to build to suit to some sort of, you know, fancier built to suit, would take a lot of community input in terms of the community understanding. Okay, to do this, we can bring in Anthony's or John Howie or, you know, one of these signature chefs, but we're going to have to pay a little bit more for it, and that means everybody's going to have to maybe put another dollar on their property taxes or approve our doing a bond or something like that. So there's a lot of community input that's going to happen before we can do so.
I have one more comment. What you decide to do on this property, if it's a ground lease or a build-to-suit, is a 40-year lease. It's well beyond most of our lifetimes. And I think that whether you feel comfortable in doing that and you want to take the easy road out, I think that's wrong. You really need to look at what a 40-year deal does for our community, for our kids and everything else. And if you need more expertise to make those decisions, don't take the easy way out. Dave has a great comment here. It's a matter of risk and it's a matter of the public community. But you've got to do it with a 40-year lifetime time frame on this. Don't do it the easy way. Do it for the kids.
I think we're statutorily limited to 50 years on an initial term of a lease and then renewals up to 80. So we can think long term.
Okay, good.
And I just really want to reiterate that we never intended or expected that we were going to come out with a do this. This is the obvious thing. Anything that we undertake here needs more conversation, a lot more thought. Pieces of it are going to need analysis. This is three steps into a whole conversation that we need to be having. So,
yeah. And so, given where we are on time, we've talked a lot about feasibility, risk, these different options. Would you mind if we jumped over that and got right into the implementation marketing strategy?
Yeah.
Okay. So on page 26 and 27 and 28, we were kind of talking about kind of the process that you may go forward with if you were to pursue any one of these concepts on either of the sites. It's not an overly complicated, it's pretty intuitive to people who have been through a transactional process. I think it's worth kind of just highlighting the phases. One of the most important ones is the beginning, so it's, we refer to it as the pre-marketing phase. And this is where you get your ducks in a row, and Ron, you asked this question of, you know, are we ready to act? And that is the right question. And it's about getting community support, it's about really understanding the site itself, so you can offer up the kind of due diligence information that anybody on either property for any use is going to need. So it's an investment of soft cost dollars, we refer to them, so additional studies that need to be done and some other research so that you're really ready to go to market. What we see, unfortunately, a lot out of the public sector is going out with a document that, you know, looks and reads like a regulatory filing. And it's fairly off-putting, and it doesn't convince anybody to do much of anything. We would often encourage the public sector to take the private sector's approach to
getting your ducks in a row, really knowing that you having things wired, and then being the very best lowercase p partner that you can be in the process. So you know what you want, and you're making, and this is a, everybody says this, but really what, if you're trying to attract investment, certainty is the most important. So just being able to define kind of where the parameters are and what you have is that is the whole purpose for that pre-marketing basis.
On the pre-marketing, I can see two ways. I saw the way Bellingham went for the hotel, and they had a really slick presentation and all. Mm-hmm. That's saying we've made a decision and we want to go after a hotel. But we're talking to some other port commissioners, and they said another way to do it, people like you and C.B. Richards in Seattle would say, here's the property. I'm going to look at a broad range of potential developers. So it's whether you focus on one or you go in the pre-marketing stage saying, hey, we've got some developable property. Can you share?
Yeah, so that's an interesting point. So the pre-marketing is really, that's the process, but it doesn't necessarily presuppose what it is the offering is. Mm-hmm. So if you reduce this down and you say, we have a site, and here are the three things that we're interested in having happen on it. The zoning may allow for other things, but you're saying you're a property owner, you've made decisions, you've worked with the community. There are three things that we're interested in seeing proposals on, and they include the following, right? And you're very explicit. And then similarly on the physical due diligence stuff, you'd say, you know, and the soil conditions are as follows, see report. And the kind of stuff that a person who is in our shoes when we're on the investment due diligence analysis side can say, okay, these are the materials I need, so I can quickly make a decision whether I want to respond or not. And that's the way you get, especially in an upmarket where there's lots of things to do, and people can go, capital and developers can go just about anywhere. You've got to make the opportunity easy to understand and quick to make a decision on it, and whether that's a public sector asset or private sector asset. Is much, much more effective.
And that, I'm sorry, just in your spreadsheet there, you had like a $300,000 number across the board on the options. That's what you're talking
yeah,
about?
Yeah, we're just putting a number to it, and it could very well range, but you know, everything from a more detailed ALTA survey, phase one, maybe a phase two environmental, you know, things like that. It's certainly geotech, given in the waterfront. You may have to continue doing more public engagement. You may need a consultant to work with you in that process. So we weren't delineating out all of the potential soft costs because they'll be defined by which site and what use. But there are some, you'll incur some costs in that process.
It was attractive to me when you said that every reason I asked the question, you said, well, it's slow for restaurant investment now. But that could change, but it could be good for hotels. So going on a broader front means, depending upon where you're on the business cycle on these various investment things,
yeah,
you might have a different response. And you want to be open to different responses because it may be a good idea, but it's not the time people are investing in this sort of thing.
Yeah, and my point is you may be open to other responses, but if you're not, if you're just truly not, it's vacation, cottage rental, or dog park. If that's the case, make it clear. Just be real explicit about that. Sorry, I don't know what I was going to say. But that's the idea being, if this is what you want to see, you put it out that way. If people respond and there's an opportunity, you can negotiate your way to something you prefer, great. And if you can't, then, you know, you're done. And it's you're not overcommitting, but it's most importantly, this you're clear, clear with the market. The second...
Before we leave that, I just want to make another point. There's the target market identification. We're talking about the types of users. But another key part to that is, as you're going out for, you know, bid for a consulting contract, you've got your roster of consultants you want to try and attract to respond. Same thing applies to the types of users. And so during this period, you'd also be developing your target list of who you'd go out to directly with this offering so that you get responses at a minimum from people that you have a strong feeling would be a compelling user or at least a compelling respondent to the site. And follow up when we get into the actual list, follow up with those people once you actually release it.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's, in a lot of cases, we'll refer to that as kind of the soft marketing. So it's this outreach that you do specifically to groups. And everybody has, you know, we'll go back to the restaurants. You know, that everybody has a restaurant that they're thinking of when we say destination or signature. And you want to make sure that you, in so much as you can, you interact with those people in advance. It's part of the bigger picture, which is having people recognize that the Port of Kingston and the community of Kingston would be a good place to do business. So it's something you do kind of naturally all the time, but it's just more pointed in this period. The second phase of that process is the outreach piece, just straight over tackling marketing, but you're putting out an offering that is kind of well thought through, and you're doing it in a much more direct way. So this isn't something where you put an ad to DJC and hope that the right group sees it, and that goes to Matt's point on preparing for that outreach. And you bring people to the site, and you really, you have to work it. It's not a passive role. And then the last one, of course, is that process of vetting proposals. So you're getting all these proposals in at once. They're hopefully, rarely do they all conform to exactly what you wanted. So there's a process of kind of working to get clarification, see what you've got, evaluating those, you know, negotiating with potentially multiple parties if you've got that kind of response, or negotiating with one that you choose is the best, and then working through the kind of transaction documentation. I will say that in that part, that's where you're getting to the form of the transaction that you want. But back in the pre-marketing piece, that's where you need to be making the decision as to what are we offering? Is it a ground lease? Is it build to suit? And that's where most of the conversation about risk needs to take place, because you can't go out not really understanding what it is you're willing to do. It'll make life a lot easier at the back end when you're negotiating a lease, a ground lease, and you know what you're getting into. You know what that return should be. You know what kind of revenue that is and what your expense is. So those are just some of the parts of the process overall. The last two pages.
Just a question. Could you bookend the time that this takes from here to here?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, basically,
what are we talking about?
So pre-marketing is oddly enough, is probably the longest period, because you're going to have to get some physical due diligence documents together. And in this case, you're going to do some additional engagement with the community. So I would guess in this context, it might take you, depending on how hard you pushed, it might take you 3 or 4 months. If you were to schedule a lot of meetings, you were to hear consensus, and you would go through that. So I think that you could do it as fast as 3 weeks if you had some materials, but I would guess here it's going to take a little bit longer. When it comes out to putting out an offering in this context, I would leave it out there for maybe only 6 weeks from the date of launch to the response requirement. If it's too long, it slips to the bottom of the pile because people don't have to respond. We're all deadline driven, so you got to kind of motivate, and then you got to make it a pretty concerted effort. And negotiating these types of leases, whether it's build-to-suit or a ground lease, that's probably like a two and a half month kind of endeavor from the first letter of intent portion of it through the ground lease, and then you've got kind of court approval. And that's if you have your ducks in a row on the legal side and you kind of progress through it accordingly. Then the developer's going to, so after the signing of that ground lease, you've got the developer's due diligence, which is a negotiated item, but let's say they need 3 or 4 months or maybe more, depending on how you negotiate it out. So, you know, then you've got permitting and groundbreaking.
Yeah.
They're not short processes. So.
Okay.
And the last two, there's a much more narrative that goes on page 28, kind of focusing on what we just talked about. And then back on page 27, we just kind of summarized some of the things that occur to us as having stared at these properties for a while and spent time here in Kingston. Some things that are intuitive to you, but the rest of the world might want to hear when it comes to the community and the opportunity here. So a lot of them have been mentioned, but the lower cost of business, the cost of doing business, the new connectivity that you're going to have, and the quality of life, which is a big deal for all types of users.
Jim, I wanted to ask if you had specific questions you wanted to ask.
No, I mean, we've been interacting through this process. Matt and I have been talking on a weekly basis anyway. They've answered all my questions.
Any other questions from this side of the table?
Thank you. Appreciate all the hard work you've done. And appreciate getting an outside input from millennials.
Definitely Carson Jones.
Okay. Well, you get the point.
Something other than baby.
I appreciate every one of you that have come today and paid attention and care.
Yeah,
thank you.
I want to thank people coming today because we tried to get different times to get more people,
And I'm sure that as we go forward on this, we'll do a lot more, both daytime and evening kinds of meetings to get input before we make any firmer decisions.
This is my first time hearing them, and I just raised her, but the quick question that I've seen, I know you guys have done a really good job, and I have a couple of millennial sons, but the one thing I've seen, and we are on a tipping, Kingston is on a tipping point that northern Florida nor the area in Seattle has had an opportunity to have. There's no place around in the Puget Sound that I've noticed that where you're going to have a ferry, the super ferry coming, or the quick ferry, the passenger ferry coming, and that close to Seattle, and still we have a pristine area. Like, you people come in, it looks inviting to the younger couple, yes it does. But another thing people don't realize is the millennials don't like to buy houses now. They like to live in apartments because they want to get out and do stuff. And the thing that I don't know if anybody's had the concept of is people in Seattle on the weekends are people, they don't want to be in Seattle anymore because Seattle, people kind of ask me about, oh, we forgot about that, oh, we forgot. Nobody wants to go to Seattle anymore because it's a mess. And Edmonds and Linwood are getting the same way. And if we don't watch it, we're going to be in the same situation, whereas if we do watch it, people are going to go, let's go to Kingston. It's a half an hour away, it's beautiful, it's pristine, and people are nice. I mean, my comment when I first moved over here was, they go, what about Kingston? And my comment was, well, instead of somebody racing ahead of you to get to the post office, they actually race ahead to open the door. And they said, perfect. And I mean, it would be a shame to lose that. And I get it with Port, which is really important, and the dry dock, but maybe do it in a different area instead of right on the beach, because you look at all the different ports and you don't see that. You don't see what we have here. Now, I've been here 8 years, so I'm considering me a week, you know. But it's just, and I really appreciate how you guys have gone and worked that hard to keep it that way. And what's scary is that stuff is starting to move faster. And it's like, oh, well, now we have to get caught up. And if we make a big mistake, it's going to be huge. And you can't go back. And we have such a little cove and a little area that one mistake or two mistakes, that's it. And, I mean, I was thinking of Edwin, and this is a perfect example, like the cottages. Well, then you have the little, you redo the house. Well, the restaurant, they could have venues where, like you were saying, a destination spot, where you have conferences where a wine area from over here brings their wines in or brings their food in, or the restaurant works with that. And you get it to the point where, oh, they're going to have a wine seminar over there. Let's group up booking. There is so much you could do, even on the lights. Kingston Lights, they could say, well, we can have the restaurant. We're doing the opening. We'll book the cottages. I mean, there's so much potential there. And if you don't get it to the point where everybody's in such a hurry to get in and out. And this is the only place in the Puget Sound right now that has that opportunity. Because if you look at the other ports, there are too many boats, too many people, all screwed up. Edmonds is screwed up as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't look pretty anymore. And we've got a really natural way. So that's all I'm going to say.
Thank you for the reminder of why we're all here.
Yes.
Ron?
I don't know what the port's going to do after all this, but I'll tell you what. If you guys could lay out what your plans are now that you've heard this and you want the public involved, and if it makes sense, I'll go get you a big audience because I want the public involved, and I'm sure they've got a lot of input. Not that that's going to, you know, help a lot, but you're going to hear a lot from us. You put out a good plan of how you're going to go ahead, and I'll get you the audience.
Well, I actually think there is some conversation that needs to happen before we get to a good plan. So, but anyway, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
What we have in front of us is our financial report, our quarterly financial review. We have a screening of our promotional video. And we have action on an agreement with a marina host. And I don't know what interest those things are. Feel free to stay, but we are going to move into our financial report and at this point. So.
Thank you.
Here we go.
Dennis Krieger, Hearthstone CPA Group. I'll speak loud enough so you can hear me. We're going to talk about the financial statements for the 6 months ended June 30th, 2017, halfway through the year. In your package, right in, let's see, I'm not sure what page, 51. So, it says draft, but they are the issued financial statements. And again, I apologize, but that was longer than I had budgeted in my time. But.
Okay.
Let's first look at, we have our standard compilation report. I don't need to explain the difference between our compilation and the audit that the state auditor does. But they take our financial statements and then they, from which they produce an audit opinion. On page 2, the statement of assets, liabilities, and equity, again, cash basis. We're only talking about the cash accounts. We don't basically include the $10 million worth of property or whatever that number is that the port owns. As of the end of June, we've got $2,487,000 in assets. Down below, we've got liabilities, including the GO bonds payable of $800,000 that were borrowed for the repairs on the covered mortgage in the port. And equity of the port at June 30th, $1,652,101. Now, again, let's just remind ourselves, these are cash basis financial statements, so accordingly, all the capital expenditures, I refer to them as CapEx, are expense. They're not added to an asset. So, because we're tracking cash. So, the next page compares the revenues and expenses for the 6 months ended June 30th from the actual expenditures to the budget. And I would just point out, first, operating revenues, slightly under budget. We'll see on page 6 that we're still chasing the transship mortgage variance that we've had, that we've talked about all throughout the year, but everything else is actually fuel sales are slightly under budget. But when we get back to page 6, we'll be able to identify that under marina user charges, that $12,616 is really related to transit mortgage income, and Jim can certainly discuss that more than I in more detail. With regard to operating expenses, again, purchase of capital assets, the first thing to note is $685,000. Again, that's primarily the covered mortgage repairs and rehabilitation. As we go down the sheet here, you'll see operating expenses of $1,577,000 and loss from operations. Again, that includes the capital expenditures, $883,674, 7/8 of the way down the page. And again, if you take out the capital expenditures of $685,000, there's a $200,000 loss during the year. And of course, where did that come from? Well, the primary item is the lawsuit judgment, $166,000. Also, we have, in terms of other items that are over budget, we have legal expenses of $10,000 over budget. We have consulting fees. We've just listened to consultants, actually at $50,000 and $33,000 over budget, again, which the budget being prorated throughout the year. So it's certainly easy to identify why our loss from operations exists as it is, and compared to budget, but we're also going to be comparing to prior years in just a minute. So when we get to the bottom line, we have a loss of $761,000. Without capital expenditures, a loss of $76,000. And of course, our property taxes are slightly over budget. We'll see on page 6 also. And interest income, some other things. So for having weathered the $166,000 judgment, I look at that and say, well, things are the capital expenditures aren't, you know, those are actually improving what's going on at the port. So having weathered the lawsuit and then all the planning that's going on, I look at that and say, okay, you know, it's nothing to panic about and something, though, to be cognizant of.
Dennison, the capital asset zeroes out.
In terms of budget, right.
Right, so we really do have a $200,000 loss.
Yes.
That's pretty concerning to me.
Well,
and we'll get to it more, but I'm kind of concerned about that negative variance.
Well, that's this, I mean, the lawsuit is what's killing it.
If you take the lawsuit out, we're only $50,000 off, and then the question occurred to me,
yes,
does this budget, maybe Jim would be the answer to this, does this report reflect our expenses on the Heartland study without yet having had the curb reimbursement?
Yes, it does.
So that's another $35,000 out of that $50,000. So
and also the $25,000 we spent on the mitigation for the taking out of West Kingston Road. We did the survey, the geotech survey. We hired Shane Phillips to come in and write technical memos. It was $25,000.
Which will be reimbursed under the OLC grant?
No.
No.
So what big ticket unbudgeted items do we have going forward?
Going forward?
Yeah, I mean, what?
Really
are, we talked about the launch ramp thing at the last meeting. Anything else? The legal issue.
Yeah. I mean, the launch ramp we're capitalizing as we are the office building, but other than that, we're not.
So, I mean, again, the lawsuit, I don't need to read it. I sat in those meetings and listened to things, but you know that's the kick in the stomach, if you will, that's hurting the operations. The next statement though, she gives us an update. What happened during June on a cash basis? Operating revenues last year versus this year. This is just the 1 month ended June 30th. Operating revenues up $14,000 compared to last year. Down under operating expenses, if you get rid of the capital expenditures, those are virtually the same as last year. And so pushing it all the way down to the bottom line, even though we've got a loss of $275,000, again, take out the capital expenditures, you actually have a $30,000 profit versus $14,000 last year.
Okay.
So, again, it's what happened early in the year. I think it was April. It was a busy season for me, I remember. I recollect the judgment came through. And, again.
Well, the capital expenditure is a pass-through from a loan, so it's
yes.
kind of not a mm-hmm. an operating cash yep. flow issue.
Right.
But,
but under our method of accounting, that yep. you know, that's what we're stuck with. Okay, now let's compare 6 months this year to 6 months last year. That's page 5. Operating revenues, $11,000 compared to last year, an increase over last year. We get down to operating expenses, and again, we peel out the $684,000, very comparable.
Mm-hmm.
We get, you know, and we push it all the way to the bottom line. We have, again, back, we have a $76,000 loss without the capital expenditures, and compared to $114,000 of income. Well, and again, it's the lawsuit that's going to impact the financial statement, the judgment that's going to impact the financial statement. That the hole that you have to dig out of. But in terms of where we're at, in terms of operations, I think June is pretty representative. You're doing, you know, better than last year on a monthly basis on your normal things.
So the loss of operations of $885,000, you've got to take out that $615,000 because that's the pass-through from the loan. Mm-hmm. So if you take that out, you're still looking at significantly less,
yes.
a little less than $200,000, which you say is accounted for
yep.
by legal expenses, which can always reoccur.
Yeah, well, that's, yes. I mean,
yeah.
Okay. Back on page 6, we now compare the budgeted revenues versus actual revenues, and again, the culprit being the transient mortgage being under budget. And we've talked about that both in April and prior to that. Everything else, fuel sales, you know, they're not up to the budgeted amount, but again, it's cash basis. We don't account for inventories. You have a 17% gross margin versus the budgeted 24%. 24% is probably too high. Historically, you've always run about 15%, as I recollect. Down below, property tax receipts are over budget by about $8,000. Interest expense, that's a timing issue. You're going to certainly, Kitsap Bank is going to want interest on their loan, and that will be, you'll be paying that. But again, it is budgeted, but not simply paid by June 30th. Next page is the comparison of revenues for the 6 months, for the month ended June 30th, this year and last year. And again, virtually everything there is over last year. We talked about that. Marina user charges $3,500 over budget, property rentals $3,400 over budget, fuel sales, you know, again, that's timing, we're on a cash basis, $7,500 relative to last year. So, again, June, hopefully that's the you know, that is what one can expect will happen forward. We don't know for sure. Then we go ahead and compare things this year, 6 months this year versus 6 months last year. And again, everything is over budget, over relative to 6 months last year. Property rentals, 14,000 higher. Gas sales, we just talked about that a minute ago, the margin. And then down below, property tax receipts, pretty comparable to last year. And then we, of course, we have to account for the change in tenant deposits as it affects our cash. So the last page, as always, rolls forward where we were last month to this month, and we start with cash at $2,457,000. We subtract liabilities at the end of May, add in the liabilities at the end of June, which includes the loan from the bank, i.e. the bonds. We have the net loss for June, and we end up with our cash investments that go back and tie back to page 2 on the financial statements. It's how we prove that we've got everything accounted for. That's your $2,487,409. So, again, there's been some rough bumps in the road here, and I'm not here. I have no idea if you're facing any more of those legally, what will happen there. We're operating compared to the revised budget in April and comparable to, relative to last year, you're doing better than last year. So, yes?
I was just curious about the transit. Curious that you weren't meeting what you expected on the transit. I was just curious on what your reason.
Well, there's no reason. Talking to other ports in the area, Paulsboro, Bremerton, Brownsville, they're all down in transient moorage. The only thing that us port directors, when we talk, think is that since fuel prices are down considerably, that people are going farther afield. They're going to the islands, they're going somewhere else and staying in Central Sound. That's purely hypothetical. But since all of us in Central Sound are down, there's something going on. That also accounts for our fuel prices. Down because gas is about 50 cents a gallon cheaper this year than it was last year. So when you're comparing dollars, that's a lot of dollars. So as they add up.
Do we have a track on the comparison of number of gallons sold?
That's a good way to do it, and I don't think we have done it in the past, but I don't see why we can't do it. We have that information.
I see it every month in
just
terms.
Do gallons this year versus gallons last year.
Well, I see the actual gallonage, so someone would have to go through and recap.
But I think that is a good way to look at it instead of dollars.
Would give us a check on the dollars.
Did you have a question?
The current status, and glad to hear that, you know, at least month June this year and last year is a bit positive. And given the whole large presentation we just saw, so does this financial statement weigh into you making a decision about whether you have any money to go forward on doing anything more about those two properties right now?
I have to categorically say, of course, that the money that's available will, of course, affect our path forward.
Because it is a
speaking.
Well, I think if you talk about planning and.
Use to do further investigation and carrying on, you know, all the aspects of the project.
I don't see it slowing us down until we were talking about significant investment. When you're talking about talking and getting your duck in a line, supposedly, I see that as not slowing that process down at all.
Consultants, which pool of money would you take that out?
Well, the consultant largely came, 75%, I think, was a grant that we got to pay for the consultants, and that was $35,000 from the CURB grant, Community Economic Redevelopment Board,
and 12,000 from us.
So that's an operating expense.
And I guess to get back and answer your question, I'd kind of disagree with Mary because I'd say no. The financial report is just a snapshot in time. And this is long-range planning for the next, as Ron pointed out, 40 years. So 1 month's report or 6 months' report isn't really, and for me, part of the equation when I'm thinking about what should we do. We have a 100-year record of operations almost, and I'm going to look at what's been our pattern for the past 5 to 10 years in terms of trying to figure out what can we afford to invest in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. And so just to clarify, I understood your question to be long-term is the amount of money available and the cost of one possibility of winning. So I was answering on a long-term basis.
Comparing financial statements like this and the history of planning with people. And so obviously, you know, you're wanting to move forward. But as a citizen whose tax dollars you're using, there's the practical part of do you have the money to do it?
I think we need to let Dennis go.
Yes,
so if there's questions for Dennis, can we focus on Dennis' questions?
Yeah.
Dennis, you're free.
Okay. And again, I didn't know I was going to.
Thank you.
You've learned more than you ever wanted
well,
to know.
Actually, the only comment I have on what we heard earlier, too, I sit on the City of Bremerton Audit Committee for many years, still do, and would just tell, and this is public information, but to attract Anthony's at the conference center, 80 parking spots in perpetuity for free. That's what it took. And Congressman Norm Dix.
Don't forget the Norm Dix.
That's right.
Yeah. Was that a bill to suit?
They were going to do it their way, or they were going to do it their way.
The support Mary's thing, $300,000 of pre-development cost is a budget item for next year. That's not a this year item. So, I mean, we couldn't say, oh, let's go out and spend $300,000 with our current budget because you saw we're tracking. So you'd have to push and pull and find out where the money's going to come from. So, you know, that's what you're worried about.
Okay, our next item is the, and Sam is here. Are you ready to do the presentation of the new port promotional video? Is there any background that you want to give us?
Sure. One of the things we're looking at doing is attracting people to Kingston as a destination. To answer your question, why aren't people coming here? When I talk to voters, they say, yeah, I forgot about Kingston. So what we're trying to do is have it more top of mind. Most people aren't getting their information the traditional way anymore. They're not looking through magazines. They're not taking ads. They're on YouTube. They're doing other things. Matter of fact, it was interesting. I was at a seminar the other day, and they said the second largest search engine on the web is YouTube. I mean, Google first and YouTube second. So we had a producer come to us who does this for a living, Pacific Northwest Voter. He does all of the destinations. He gave us a proposal to do a promotional video that he puts on his site. It's now on our site, and it's also on YouTube. It's amazing. The first day it was out, we had 103 views, and it was amazing. 103 people watched it. So I think it's going to be informative, and I think you did a great job of showcasing our community.
If I can get this darn thing to work, I apologize. I didn't get alone time with this television before the meeting started, so...
Can we move on with the agenda?
Go ahead and do the Marina host agreement while you work with that, Sam. Could you describe what it is we are?
Sure. We have been talking about this for a few weeks. We think it's a very valuable commodity to have what we're going to affectionately call a Marina host. It's a lot like a campground host for our Marina. The issue is that when staff leaves at 5 o'clock at night, there are a lot of people that know we're gone, and if they come in at 5:30 and leave by 7 in the morning, they get free mortgage for the night. So we don't really have a set of eyes and ears at the port in the evening.
not only for lost revenue, but also for emergencies and other things that happen. So there is a growing group of marinas that are having this marina host program. Matter of fact, we have one right here. The marina host for the Port of Brownsville is with us. So we wanted to institute it, but what that takes is the addition of another position. Even though it's not a full paid position, it would be a credit to somebody's marina fees, if you will, to allow them to just kind of walk around, make sure things are in order. One of the problems we're having, and a lot of citizens know, is the Toth property we use as a park. And a lot of people would like to come and use that park after 5 o'clock. And we have no way of locking that after 5 o'clock. Marina host, it could be a good idea for him to go up at 8 o'clock or her and lock the Toth property, which would give the community more time in that park. So there's a lot of advantages to it. We think that it's a good program, and we'd like to get commission concurrence to move forward. So what we presented here is a guide for what that person would do. And I really want to stress that this isn't a full-time employee to do a lot. This is a person on site to be the eyes and ears. And really, if there's a situation, the most important thing this person can do is call 911. And we don't have that ability right now. So, with that, the commissioners had a chance to review it. Both commissioners have made comments. Mary, I believe.
I did make comments verbally to you in the previous meeting.
Right, we got that in there. So what you see here is a compilation of Walt and Bruce's input.
I didn't have any other comments or changes after I saw this version. So
I talked to Sam about my comments, and we talked through them, and I'm comfortable that you did what you could. If, you know, sometimes I'm out there, you know. So.
I see a couple of things that I assume Carolyn changed in it. The most significant was that this person is an independent contractor now, not as an employee.
But we still need to pay L&I.
Yeah.
Right. So we determined that we still have to pay L&I for that person. So, yeah, Carolyn went through and made a lot of good.
Just that one comment. You shouldn't change it, but I think we should inform Enduris.
Oh, yes. Definitely.
Because they may put some restrictions on it. We want to make sure we're covered with anything that might involve the host,
sure.
You know, so that they may have some input that we don't understand.
As soon as the commission approves moving forward, Enduris will get a copy of this. Yeah.
And then if there are changes that they want to see made, you would bring them back to us. Okay. Any other comments about this? Is there a motion to approve the marina host guidelines?
Well, I would move that we approve the marina host guidelines and authorize the executive director to move forward with the marina host position.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you.
There you go.
Okay. So now we can see the promotion.
If I may, I'm going to leave this here with you because you guys need to be able to hear it. You can adjust the volume as needed.
Okay. Up here about the middle.
Yeah. Make it louder.
Yeah, easier said than done. Which one? Oh.
Hold on. I got it tight.
Maybe you could tell them how to get it on their computers.
Of course. Well, you can get it on your computer by going to either YouTube or going to the port's website. And that scroll, once you click on it, I will make an adjustment. It looks like the automatic scrolling is defaulting that the YouTube video shuts down, so I'll fix that once we're done with the meeting today.
What's it listed as on YouTube?
On YouTube, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to Port Kingston.
Okay.
And if you do Port of Kingston, you can actually find it from Pacific Northwest. You can also go direct to PacificNorthwestCoder.com.
We've been to the Port of Kingston Marina a few times over the years, mostly for fuel. But after spending the weekend here, we now know why Kingston is a great boating destination. The marina and town are located on the Kitsap Peninsula in the northern part of Puget Sound, just 12 miles from downtown Seattle. Getting here is easy, although you need to be aware at all times of the Washington State ferries, especially if you're coming from the north, as you'll be crossing a very busy ferry route. You'll find the marina entrance just south of the ferry terminal. And while the entrance to the marina is fairly tight, the recommended approach from the southeast will give you plenty of room and depth. Just be sure to keep the red buoy to starboard and the green navigator to port, and you'll be fine. As you can see here, even at an extreme low tide, there is plenty of depth in the middle of the channel. A total of 58 guest slips are on G-Dock, which runs the length of the breakwater. If you're heading for the 40 and 50-foot slips, keep an eye on the wind and direction, as there is one more tight squeeze to manage. However, there is plenty of room to maneuver in the turning basin just off the fuel dock. Vessels up to 80 feet can tie up on the linear dock just inside the marina entrance. And if you call ahead, either on the phone or VHF channel 65 Alpha, someone will be there to catch your lines. And that, it turns out, is just the beginning of a very service-oriented marina.
Some of the amenities that a boater can expect to find when they come stay with us in Kingston. We've got everything from you can make reservations for your slip. We've got amazing fuel prices. We do have the dockside pump out. You do still have to do it yourself, but we bring your card to you. We also offer, of course, you know, hot showers. Those are free charge, not point off. We have laundry facilities. We do have the dockside check-in service. That's for incoming reservations, or even just transient boaters coming in for 4 hours.
Well, thank you. That was easy.
All slips have fresh water and 30 amp shore power. There's also 50 amp power at the larger slips. There are two covered picnic shelters right on the dock. The Kingston Cove Yacht Club offers reciprocal moorage on a first-come, first-served basis. And if the marina happens to be full, the port operates free mooring buoys just north of the ferry terminal in Apple Tree Cove. The fuel dock, which is known for having some of the lowest prices in Puget Sound, has Valvetech gas and diesel, including a high-speed pump. There's also a pump-out here. The dinghy dock has a second pump-out, as well as a porta-potty station. At the west end of the marina, you'll find a boat launch. This is also where future boaters learn to sail in the junior sailing program. But the best part about staying here is the historic and walkable town of Kingston itself. Just steps away from your boat, you'll find a variety of shops and eateries. Everything from coffee and espresso, yummy baked goods, restaurants and cafes, colorful candies and chocolate. And if you're looking for adult beverages, there are a few watering holes right in downtown Kingston. And of course, for all ages, ice cream for dessert. There are even more restaurants and stores a few blocks up the hill. But if that's too far for you to walk, the Port of Kingston has you covered.
We also offer free use of our electric cars to all of our paying guests. We have two electric gen cars. We have a two-door and a four-door, and you can go out and about and provision, have a good time, just don't get a speeding ticket.
We took the four-door up to the grocery store and found everything we needed. We also found the post office, a hardware store, boating supplies, and an auto parts store. The Firehouse movie theater, too. But even if you don't take one of the port's electric cars for a spin, you can still find all sorts of things to do in Mike Wallace Park, right next to the marina.
We have a summer concert series that the Greater Kingston Chamber of Commerce puts on every year. It's really amazing, a great assortment of bands. We do have a farmer's market on Saturdays, and lots of public events, everything from stuff for kids to art festivals to flea markets. Lots of music, lots of food, lots of fun.
If you're feeling really lucky, the Point Casino and Hotel, located just outside of Kingston, will come pick you up and bring you back with their free shuttle service. And if you're looking for 18 holes, the Whitehorse Golf Course will come pick you up in their free shuttle too. The town of Kingston really goes out of the way to entertain and make boaters feel welcome. And the attentive Port of Kingston staff is on hand to make sure your stay is as comfortable as possible. You can easily make reservations online. Just visit portofkingston.org and fill out the secure slip reservation form. You can also reserve your slip or inquire about yacht club or boating club rendezvous by calling the marina office at 360-297-3545. On the port website, you'll also find current fuel prices as well as links to community events. From one Pacific Northwest boater to another, I'm Darren O'Brien. We'll see you on the water.
Nice.
Very much.
Yeah.
Drone is amazing. It's just quiet everywhere. Total control.
So was that Kevin who was here?
Oh, no, this is Seth Goodstein.
Oh, okay.
Carolyn.
Yeah. Goodstein.
The Goodstein son.
Yeah, the son.
Son of Goodstein.
Son of Goodstein. Okay, that's our attorney. Our attorney.
Okay.
He left for some reason. Maybe something we said.
So did. Is there other public comment? This has been a lot of texture in this meeting, and most everyone has left, but I'm interested if anyone has any other comment.
I can't give you my husband's comment. He's out of town, this is great. When I told him I was coming in, what the topics were, and his father ran a boatyard, and his family was marine and that used to, so his comment cool. Was, why are they doing anything other than boats? And I said, no, their mission is not. It's like, no, they should just do it. So, not my opinion.
Yeah, he's a marine biologist,
he's
right?
He's an old Cape Codder boat guy. Yeah. So.
Got it.
Yeah.
So, did you have a director report?
I did. Just real quick, because we've spent a lot of time today already. Most of you are up to date on what's happening, how the board is progressing, as is the office building. I did want to bring you a draft of the community agreement, or the agreement for community sign. So the county attorney drafted this, and then I had our attorney go over it, and what you'll see is Carolyn's line in, line out. This is an agreement that would allow the county to basically allow us to place a sign on their road easement. And the legal descriptions there along with the map, so this would give us that authority. So anyway, first reiteration, I told Carolyn, let's give it to you and have you all review it, and then we would send it back to the county after you made your comments. Pretty simple agreement, but let me know any comments in the next week or so that you might have so I can send them back to Kitsap County. The thing that I realized when I was putting this together is that it's the end of July. I just can't believe it's the end of July already. And you know what August is, and that's budget starting time. So we're going to start thinking about 2018 here pretty quick, and any input that you all can give me on direction you'd like to see 2018 budget going. I would like to get this a review for you all in September of the budget, and then actually approve it in October if we possibly can. And those 3 months are going to fly by. The other thing I want to talk about is KCAC next week. It's going to be a pretty good KCAC meeting, I believe. It would be great if you all could have come. Dave Wetter and Colleen are going to be hosting a series of roundtables on basically everything Kingston. And they're going to have Cam Fletcher there. They're going to have Nikki Monroe there. They're going to have Amy from Cup of Muffin there. So it's going to be talking about downtown business. I think it's kind of important for us all to hear what's going on with that. But that's all I have to report this month.
Any questions for Jim?
Yeah, on the Washington Boulevard Park.
there were noises. It's a lot of uncertainty about the availability of the RCO funding. And I heard one thing saying, yes, if it's 15, 17, it's not a problem, and other people saying no. If you could just touch base with the regional.
So I did.
Yep.
I talked to the regional director.
Yeah.
And our grant is authorized.
Okay, so.
They have funding for ours. They
okay.
They're not proceeding with any new stuff right now.
Got it.
We have our $400,000.
That's great.
So we are starting.
That's a comforting slot.
Yeah, we're going out to bid in January for this, and hopefully start construction in April. We all know we have to be done by the end of next year totally, all the paperwork and everything. The county is on a 19 schedule, as I said. They won't start until winter of 19. But they've made a generous offer to us where if we build the park, they will come in and build all the sidewalks and pay for it themselves.
The county.
Yeah, which is a huge expense because they're requiring 10-foot sidewalks. That's not cheap.
So they'll cover the regrading.
Yep, they're going
to
regrade.
Of our property, which has to right. now be raised up. Yeah, okay.
Other? Okay, so the next question is commissioner reports. We just spent several days at a commissioner conference put on by the Washington Public Ports Association, and with many meaty sessions, work sessions, and I wondered if either of you had.
I think I just try to write my notes up and send them out rather than go, because you all heard
yeah.
everything. So I'll write up a little trip report with my notes, and you send it to Jim, and
okay.
that would save us all some time.
Yeah, I'm going to just one comment to pass along to Jim, and real briefly, in terms of thinking about next year's budget, employee health insurance costs. An idea that was tossed out that I picked up on was the idea of several small ports pooling together to create a larger pool and hopefully maybe get a little price benefit on that. David something, who's a commissioner over in Edmonds, I'm trying mm-hmm. to think of it, wears the dark rimmed glasses.
Yeah.
Apparently, he is an insurance broker in that mm-hmm. field and would be a good resource to maybe talk to see just what can be done there and what we might expect in terms of benefit from that kind of effort. Because I was thinking if we could get just the Kitsap County ports together, that would make it.
Yeah. And there weren't very many of the Kitsap County ports there, represented there.
Brownsville was there.
Allen. And it's not Kitsap County.
Illahee was there.
Bremerton was kind of there with Kerry Bozeman.
Yeah.
Axel was there, too.
Yes,
Axel was there.
Yeah.
And we were there in force.
Yeah.
And Brownsville was there. I don't know who else. Yeah.
But I think the whole conversation about whether there's a small port insurance pool would be a worthwhile thing to bring mm-hmm. up. There is a meeting monthly of the ports in Kitsap County. And it's an opportunity to discuss everything from this kind of concept to a mutual aid agreement that was developed and among all the different ports in case somebody needed somebody's either rescue or equipment or whatever, and so that's a useful communication for him. Any staff comments, Sam?
Well, I do have, on behalf of our controller, Juanita Gomez. She was not able to attend today, but I do have material to distribute to the board on her behalf. Interpretation thereof, unfortunately, is not going to be my strong suit, so I'm going to leave it to the reader.
Yeah, any questions you might have on this, you could just address it to one.
What, do you know when she's expected to return?
Monday.
Monday? Okay.
All right, here we go. We can pass those down.
Okay.
Yeah.
Our next regular meeting is Wednesday, August 23rd at the same time. We also, most Tuesday mornings at 9 o'clock, have a work session that is without an agenda because it is basically our director, Jim's opportunity to tell us what he's doing and what we need to be aware of. We started doing that after last year's commissioner conference that we went to, and this is a great way to deal with not knowing from month to month and needing to make sure that all three commissioners are aware. And so that we all talked at the conference about what a good tool we think that is and how appreciative we are of your preparation for it every week. So, if public's invited, it's down at the Yacht Club. So, 9 o'clock Tuesday mornings. And it's listed on the report website. So, if you were interested in coming, which again is several of you have been there, feel free. But if it's not listed on the website, that means for some reason it was canceled that week.
Just a comment on that. Yeah. These are information meetings, unless we say it's going to be making a decision. So we might have something come up and we've got to make a decision. So we'll make a decision there. But check the website. If a decision is going to be made, it'll be announced. But otherwise, it's just to get information. Here's where we make decisions.
Yes. And what we do in that case, if we need to make a decision, we turn it into a special meeting so that we have all of the protocols and coverages in place for making those decisions. Yes.
So at those Tuesday morning meetings, public's invited, do we just listen on those, or is there any interactive aspect?
It's interactive.
Yeah. We'll take public comment.
Just they make no decisions.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
We'll have to
so it's a legal meeting, you know, so all the rules apply.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So we'd like to have company.
So I think this meeting is adjourned. I don't remember when we've had a 3-hour meeting. It's been a long time.
Yes, I'm Mary. For the record, a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Aye.
Aye.
Just a second.
Okay.